Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
That's a nappy headed horse.
Nationwide, the natural hair community is growing. Between 2011 and 2016, sales of hair straighteners, also known as relaxers, fell 31%. Relaxers are made up of chemicals that flatten the natural kinks in many African Americans' hair. 90.5 WESA's Allegra Battle reports Pittsburgh's natural hair community is seeing an increase in new membership, too.
Good morning.
Sisters Beauty Supply in downtown Pittsburgh is owned by Renita White and her family. The store carries a wide array of hair products.
We sell a lot, especially the leave-in conditioner. It does well in the conditioner, the regular conditioner. And then all the different types of oils. Grapeseed oil, the carrot oil. A lot of people like to use those for mixing different types of oils to put in their hair.
White says within the last 3 years, she's noticed a change in attitude surrounding natural hair. Another Pittsburgher also spotted that trend early on. Tamiya Bridget started the Natural Hair Meetup Group, It's a Natural Thing, 8 years ago.
I think everyone was so excited just to have a space to just feel free to discuss, everything.
Beyond the online community and Facebook group, members of It's a Natural Thing attend quarterly meetups where they discuss natural hair and the day-to-day challenges faced by many black women. There are also workshops on ways to style hair, hair product demonstrations, and even fashion shows. Bridget says she wants to create a space for natural hair because some still view it as taboo, even in the black community.
It's the mindset of just your hair is ugly, your hair is bad, your hair is not good enough. And the more you feel that way about your hair, you never see it as what it is. You'll always just see it as the other N-word.
That other N-word is nappy, a derogatory term for Afro-textured hair. 5 years ago, Bridget opened the group to men and multiracial families. She says there was some pushback from members who felt that opening up the group would invade that sacred space that was reserved for black women. But Bridget says it was important for her to invite those new members, especially white parents with black children.
These children are going to grow up, with Afro-textured hair or, coily textured hair. Their parents need to know how to do their hair. And instead of starting a separate group, I just made it where, they can feel free to join and that they have a place to reach out and feel included.
June Wolf of Beaver County is a member of the group. Wolf is white and her 4.5-year-old adopted daughter, Leocadia, who goes by Katie, is black.
I joined it, for Katie and more about Katie and letting her have that community. I mean, her being able to celebrate, basically her black girl magic and everything else is really important, right?
Wolf wants her daughter to embrace her natural hair. She says she gets a lot of good information from the group, like which hair products to use. Some products soften while others add moisture to Katie's thick, curly hair.
I just want her to be able to feel confident and beautiful the way she's. You are beautiful, I know. There's so many white and Eurocentric beauty standards that society tries to push on people, and I don't want it having her feel like she's not enough.
In the Black community, hair is a complicated issue. Bridget says historically the idea of good hair, or European textured hair, was considered more beautiful and acceptable than African American hair. But that may be changing. According to the research firm Mintel, 71% of Black adults in the U.S. wore their hair natural in 2016. Wolf says she's always learning new styles and techniques for her daughter's hair, including Katie's favorite, her puff.
She calls her puff her princess hair. That's her favorite.
Because it's beautiful in ponytails. I like it with my princess hair.
Wolf says she's grateful she connected with Pittsburgh's natural hair community. It's a Natural Thing now has over 7,000 members from across the country. Founder Tamaya Bridget is getting ready for the group's next big event, a meetup at Alpha Lab Gear in East Liberty this summer. I'm Allegra Battle, 90.5 WESA News.
Is a voluntary, free-spirited, open-ended program of procreative racial deconstruction.
Everybody just got to keep fucking everybody till they're all the same color.
It's Friday, so it's time for StoryCorps. Pamela McKinney dreamed that she'd grow up, get married, and have kids, but it didn't quite work out that way. She wound up raising her daughter Courtney on her own.
So what do you remember of the story I tell you about your dad?
That his name was Charles, and he was white, and you guys had a brief relationship, and it didn't work out. And I just really distinctly remember not believing it.
Courtney was right to be suspicious. When she was 16, she learned that her mom had actually conceived through an anonymous sperm donation. 10 years later, Courtney discovered through an online DNA test that she had a half-sister, Alexandra Sanchez.
So I messaged you, and I was like, any chance that you had a donor as a father?
When I got your message, I just started crying. And hearing your voice for the first time was amazing, to say the least. I always wished for siblings. That's the one thing I always dreamt of. And so when we actually met for the very first time, when you ran up and hugged me, just the feeling, the intense feelings inside, I just knew.
We went to go have lunch, and remember there was like these two guys sitting next to our table, totally eavesdropping. I swear one of them even like pushed his chair over so he could hear us.
I remember thinking, this is the first time I get to have a beer with my sister. I grew up thinking that I looked exactly like my mother until I met you. I remember us looking at each other and saying, oh, you have freckles.
Yeah.
And of course, the smile and the way our chins curve. I remember getting in the car and my husband said, I have a sister-in-law. And I was thinking, could this all be true?
I just look forward to learning how to be a sister. It's such a weird thing to do at 28 years old.
It's something we both have a learning to do in. We didn't get to grow up together, but we will get to grow old together.
Alexandra Sanchez and her sister Courtney McKinney, their StoryCorps interview will be archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress.
On this Father's Day, that of all the rocks upon which we build our lives, we are most dependent on the family. The family is that most important foundation. And we are called to recognize and honor how critical every father is to that foundation. They are teachers and coaches, they're mentors, and they're role models. They are examples of success and the men who constantly push us towards success. But if we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that too many fathers are also missing. Too many fathers are MIA. Too many fathers are AWOL.
This Sunday is Father's Day, a good time to reflect on the role of fathers and just what it means to be a good dad. The North Carolina Fatherhood Conference takes a day to look at those questions. Each year, the Family Resource Center South Atlantic hosts the event. It's geared to giving dads the tools and guidance they need to create stronger bonds with their children. And joining me now is Derek Bird, co-founding member and program director of Family Resource Center South Atlantic. That's in Raleigh, and he is also one of the minds behind the annual Fatherhood Conference. Thanks for joining us, Derek.
Thank you.
Also with us today is a panelist from the Fatherhood Conference, Dion Showtime Chavis, nighttime radio personality at K97.5, which is the Triangle's hip-hop and R&B station. Dion, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Let me ask you, Derek, what inspired you to launch this conference?
Well, the Family Resource Center was had been involved in looking at how we can better serve families in our respective programs. And I would say a consistent thread that continually kept popping up was the fact that, where we worked more with families where they was headed by women, and that there was definitely a need to figure out how to better engage and involve the fathers, or at least those non-custodial fathers who still were involved with families and in strengthening their capacity to be even better engaged. So we really felt that there was a need to begin to start really addressing how we can look to strengthen fatherhood across the state, and particularly in the areas and the counties that we were serving. And so the idea of a conference came up as a result of the work that I had started to engage in when I worked at Wake County Human Services, and we were looking at dads and how we could better involve dads in our programs and services through Wake County.
Yeah, that's interesting. You're working for Wake County Human Services, and that's when you begin to notice that every time you turn around and try to help the dads, the programs just aren't there. Lots of stuff in place for moms, but right, not so much for dads. So what was missing? What would have helped?
Well, I think that the gap is kind of there's a lot of different gaps, let me just say right. that. I think there's institutional gaps where, again, historically a lot of programs and services and organizations just never really purposely made a point of making sure that there were programs for fathers or that they geared programs for fathers. I think socially and emotionally that there's, again, a gap just based on some of the things that were happening in our communities and respectively culturally, where fathers just typically that role was just for either diminished or just not acknowledged, that it was definitely a needed element in strengthening and maintaining families within the community.
Well, Dion, tell us what made you get involved with the Fatherhood Conference.
Well, I've been working in fatherhood and as an active father in my daughter's life. I saw that, as Derek said, that there was a need for fathers to start becoming more engaged. And, I just wanted to start using my testimony and using my story to influence fathers and kind of give fathers the extra push that they need if they weren't active in their child's life, and just to kind of understand the importance of responsible parenting and fatherhood, and just know the role that we as fathers play in our kids' lives.
Well, tell us that story and what got you involved.
Well, my daughter is 14, and her mother and I haven't always had the best relationship. So, similar to a lot of fathers out there, I was going in and out of court for custody and things of that nature just to fight the battle to see my daughter and to spend time with her. So, I felt like if I was going through it, I knew there were thousands of other men out there who were going through the exact same situation. So just going through court and paying for lawyers and, paying all of these court fees just to basically be able to spend my daughter. I tell people all the time, it's easier to go to the courts and say, hey, I want to relinquish all my fatherhood rights, as opposed to going in and saying, I want to be an active part in my child's life. So for me, I fought that fight for years and years and years. And finally, I just said, I want to help other people and help other people get an understanding of this system is not as easy as it seems for fathers who want to be a part of their children's lives.
Well, and what is it about being a part of your child's life that was so important to you? And how did you reflect on that? Because as you go through this process, it's hard. And so you have to tell yourself, I really mean this, and start even thinking, I would guess, more deeply about why this is important.
Right. Well, I was raised without a father, and I didn't want my daughter to go through the same things that I went through. I wanted to be sure that she knew that I would always be there for her. And I wanted to make sure that she didn't, she never wanted for anything. She never doubted my love. She never doubted, because a lot of times when kids go through these types of situations where the fathers aren't present, then they start to lack in school. They start to, become less active as far as physical abilities. They start to, start doing drugs and start drinking and, you know, engaging in sexual activities at an earlier age. So I just wanted to be sure that, you know, my daughter just didn't become a statistic. And I did everything that I could do to be sure. I moved from Virginia to North Carolina, 3 hours away, and dropped everything in Virginia to move here and just to be closer to her, because I knew the impact that I was having on her life was going to be greater than anything that I could ever do.
Well, I know that your daughter is happy that you did that, and the radio community here in the Triangle is also happy that you did that. Yeah, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Derek, let me ask you a little bit. You said something earlier about the role of fathers is underappreciated, and I think you made reference to our community. So I'm assuming you're talking about it within African-American communities, that the role might be underappreciated. Are you saying more generally?
Well, generally, but of course it does it manifests itself more so in our African American and Latino communities. And I think, again, that is not necessarily because that's something that we do internally. That's all of the external factors.
So what is that? What are those factors? What are those pressures that make it even more difficult to?
Well, I think we just, again, just look at the, you know, the institutional inability to, you know, purposely make sure that there are services and programs tailored to fathers.
And what are those programs? What do they look like? How do you help fathers?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that we found in our task force is that, you know, there is, you know, a lot of our institutions where there are, particularly in our social services institution, they're very heavily staffed with women. So you have to look at what are those biases that women already have towards men, and how do they transfer their own experiences to that work. So that's one thing. Secondly, again, you know, historically, institutions just always catered to mothers. Mothers were seen as the caretakers, the nurturers, you know, and the ones who basically had the responsibility of really working with and managing the children. Dad was out just, you know, working and, you know, and financially supporting the family, but never was given that option or allowed to be that nurturer and to be the person who the school called or take the child to the doctor when they were sick and things like that. So everything was always geared towards mom and not dad. So that's one of the challenges and barriers that men in general parenting have had to go through. And then there's a whole host of other things that we look at just historically with African-American Latino families, that, you know, racial equity and access. You know, if men are working and that's their role and responsibility to that degree to assure that financially they're supporting their families, if they are in need of services, well, if everything's closed at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, how are they going to access these services and programs? You know, and then they need to be very specific to, you know, what men and what fathers really need, because you can't provide what you do in a parenting class for moms that's going to transfer and be the same for dads. So you really have to be very intent in making sure that you're doing something specifically geared towards fathers.
So those are suggestions for changing the institutions, the way in the framework, the way in which we deliver services. What do you tell the dads when they come to your conference? What programs do you have for them that can guide them and help them be better fathers?
Well, what the conference does is it allows for us to have a conversation, a celebration, and a reconciliation around strengthening fatherhood. So we celebrate, we have a conversation around why is it important that dads matter? Why is it important that men are fathers are engaged and involved with their children and their families? What are the benefits of that? What are the challenges? What are the barriers? And then the celebration comes, you know, to the fact that we have to be willing to celebrate who we are as fathers, and that we do matter, and that we are acknowledged and recognized, at least within our own community, that we are doing a great job and we're contributing to our families and to our children's well-being and to our community, and that is something that is not often done enough. And then the reconciliation is coming with, okay, so now that we have done all of this, where do we continue to start to do this work, and who can we bring on board as a collective or as a collaborative to help make sure that we are creating a culture and a process that allows for father engagement, father involvement across North Carolina.
Dion, you have blogged about this. You've spoken about this. Things fathers should be doing to be more engaged.
Sure.
Give us some suggestions and some tips and things that you think dads ought to be paying attention to.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, my daughter is 14 and I'm the father of a newborn who's just 4 months old at this point. So I'm starting to do it all over again. But just from this 14-year journey so far, you know, as fathers, one thing that always sticks out to me is how many fathers think that they have to spend a certain amount of money to see their child, or they have to spend money and get their children the best shoes or take them to the biggest amusement park, when at the end of the day, these kids only want time. You know, the time that we spend with our kids is what matters the most. It's what they're going to remember the most. So first and foremost, I think as fathers, we have to realize that time spent is more important than anything else. It's more important than any dollar amount that you could ever spend. But also just find a way to kind of build a bridge with your kids and find, you know, what are they into? You know, a lot of kids these days are into technology. A lot of kids these days are into social media. They're into music. They're into all of these things. That's kind of what I talk about during my workshop at the conference. Like, how can we as fathers meet the kids where they are? How can we find out what they're into, what they're involved in, and just infuse our love for them into that? One of the things that my daughter, just as an example, we started our own YouTube channel. So we have a YouTube channel called The Glad Dad. So on The Glad Dad, I saw that she was interested in doing challenges. And, you know, we were seeing all of these Bean Boozled challenge and all of these crazy challenges. And I said, well, I can do that. And, you know, I decided we was something that we would do together. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's something that, you know, oh, you know, you're on YouTube with your child. But for me, it's just the ability to spend time with her and to be able to go back and kind of document her growth over the last 5-7 years. I'll go back and look at the first video that we recorded, right, and she's a totally different person at this point, you know, 5 years later. So just kind of finding those interests and connecting with the children and, you know, just meeting them where they are.
You talked about the importance of social media. And by the way, I 4-month-old, so congratulations.
Thank you.
And so that's two children. Let me tell you, as an experienced father, everything that you learned in raising your daughter, useless for the second child. Throw it out the window.
I
mean, makes no difference.
No,
you are a rookie all over again.
Yes,
okay?
Yes, yes.
So let me just
with
say that.
No sleep.
That's right, and no sleep. No sleep. And, by the way, you're older.
Right. Yes, and
all
slower.
Of that.
Yes, and slower. And these kids are faster, so.
But that aside, social media, that's the other thing. And there, that's, particularly as kids move into teenage, that's where they want to be alone.
Yeah.
They want to be separate
right.
from you. So how do we deal with all of that? How deeply engaged do we become in their social media networks?
Yeah, I think it's rough. I think it's really hard. But I think, you know, a lot of times as parents, we can kind of fall to the pressure of saying my child has to have social media at this point. My daughter was 13 before I even let her get her first social media. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I told her she could choose one, and she chose Snapchat. Because these kids are so used to, you know, having technology and being able to do certain things as far as gaming. And, you know, I tell anybody, like, they come out of the womb with a phone in their hand and a tablet in their back pocket. They know how to work these gadgets better than you and I ever could. So we have to find a way to not necessarily let them fall into the pitfalls of social media, you know, because cyberbullying is a real thing. And, you know, the differences between our generations, Frank, is that, you know, if someone was going through something at school, that issue stopped at 3 o'clock when the bell rang or when you got off the school bus. Now those issues continue because the kids are still connected with each other after school. So if there's an issue going on with bullying, if there's an issue going on with someone being teased about their weight or whatever the case may be, there's no disconnect. So in my house, we have a rule, all social media and all electronics go off at 9 o'clock. So at 9 o'clock, we turn the phone off and that's it. And we can't be afraid to take those devices away. And at dinner time, there's no phones at the table during dinner time at my house. So, you know, as parents, we kind of have to realize that we are still the ones who make the rules, and we have to model the same behaviors that we want our kids to display. You know, a lot of times we don't want our kids to pick on people on social media, but at the same time, we go back and talk about, oh, well, this person didn't get enough likes on this picture and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have to model the behavior that we want to see, and they can kind of look at that. And
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night. News said they did $1 million worth of damage. Every black person was watching that like amateurs.
From early state laws that opposed African-American settlers to KKK members influencing politics in the 1920s, the Beaver State has seen its share of racial prejudice. Eliza Canty Jones is editor of the Oregon Historical Quarterly. She says its winter 2019 issue will be entirely devoted to this topic.
Everything from the pioneer era white supremacy to labor history, including unions, to organized resistance work and resistance leaders. Those are some of the subjects that are called out there.
Jones adds Eugene itself had a so-called clavern roughly a century ago that drew people in with its 100% Americanism stance. She notes that white nationalist and Nazi graffiti continues to plague the city. Proposals for articles are due June 18th. Brian Bull, KLCC News.
Back in 1959, a physician in Biloxi, Mississippi, led a group of black people onto a segregated beach to protest discrimination. The protesters were repulsed by white homeowners and the police, but the wade-in, as it was dubbed, became part of the civil rights movement, not only in the Deep South, but also in the North. Connecticut and other northern states also had a long history of wealthy white folks barring people of color and the less affluent from their sandy shorelines. So in the 1960s, the Connecticut beaches on Long Island Sound became the target of wade-ins, often led by activist Ned Cole. Historian Andrew Carl has written a book titled Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Andrew, welcome to Living on Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Please describe for us briefly what the beaches were like along the Connecticut shore in the 60s and 70s and who got to use them.
Well, they were very limited in their public access. It was a 253-mile shoreline. 72 miles of it was white sand beaches, and of that, only 7 miles were open to the public. The rest were in the hands of private homeowners, private beach associations, which were sort of like gated communities, as well as clubs and other residential corporations. So it was a shoreline that was effectively off limits to the general public. It was something that really was exclusive to the upper middle class and wealthy communities that were fortunate enough to live or own summer cottages along the shore.
So onto this scene of unequal beach access comes Ned Cole. Who was he and what led him to lead a campaign to free the beaches?
Yeah, so Ned Cole was a young white Irish Catholic, recent college grad, who in 1964, he was working in a comfortable job in the insurance industry in Hartford, Connecticut, and had, you know, was very distraught after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, sensed that spirit of a kind of new frontier of volunteerism, of civic engagement was in danger after his death, and quit his job and decided to found an anti-poverty organization called Revitalization Corps. He fashioned it as a domestic peace corps that aimed to get middle-class white Americans, primarily those who sort of were living in sort of relative privilege and comfort, to become more involved in solving the problems of poverty, of segregation, and of racism in America. He came to the issue of beach access almost by accident. He and the volunteers, many African-American mothers who lived in the communities where he was serving, wanted to sort of find ways to get children out of the city during the summer, give them more cultural enrichment activities, whether it be trips to, you know, the countryside or other excursions. And, you know, they just decided during the summer of 1971 that they would start leading trips down to the shore. They didn't think of it as a protest at all. They thought of it as just another sort of activity that they could do during the summer when kids are out of school. They loaded up a bus of children and mothers and headed down to the state shoreline and discovered that there was very little access available to them. There was few places that they could actually go. And the beaches that they did try to access, they were not welcomed at.
Hey, remind us how much access that poor black kids growing up in public housing in the 60s and 70s had to places where they could play or cool off on hot summer days there in Connecticut, whether it's Bridgeport or Hartford or whatever.
No, this was a real serious issue. I mean, you know, this was something I talked a lot about in the book, is how, you know, the summer season really brought a whole host of injustices and deprivations into focus. And it was oftentimes as a result of tragedy. There was a shockingly high number of children in cities like Hartford and Harlem and in many cities across the country that would drown each summer, oftentimes, you know, playing in unsupervised bodies of water. And they were there because there was few other options available. This was something that the Kerner Commission, which studied civil disorder in the 1960s and looked to sort of understand the roots of African-American unrest, found that, in fact, recreation and the sort of lack of decent and safe places of recreation ranked very high on the list of African-American grievances in some of the cities that were racked by violence during these years.
What did the law say about the public right to access the beach, and where did the idea that beaches belonged to everyone come from originally?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that the shoreline belonged to the public originated in the Roman Empire. In the year 530 CE, the Roman Emperor Justinian proclaimed that shorelines are common to mankind, that they're subject to the same law as the sea itself, and that no one can be forbidden from approaching them. This idea, which later became known as the public trust doctrine, you know, has deep, deep roots in Western law. It was formed the basis of English common law, you know, this notion that beaches were public land, and then it became part of American common law with the founding of the Republic. So this notion that beaches are public property has deep, deep roots in American law.
So Ned Cole begins really a campaign to free the beaches. And he takes this busload of kids and mothers down to the shore, and there's not a lot of access. What's the turning point when he decides, hey, I need to make this a cause?
Yeah, no, it really, I think you can sort of date it back to that summer of 1971 when they went to the town of Old Lyme, Connecticut, which was one of the many old upper middle class wealthier communities along the shore, and were greeted very hostily by the homeowners, who felt as if, you know, this was their private beach. This was a, you know, they were trying to sort of access a private beach association's shoreline. The sort of anger and hostility that greeted him really unnerved him and woke him up to some of the realities of racism in these places that had not really been on their radar. I mean, these are isolated, you know, small sort of little summer enclaves of people of sort of great privilege. And it turned his attention to seeking to first engage with these communities. And as they became increasingly resistant and hostile to his very presence, seeking to sort of, you know, protest and draw attention to this issue.
There's a passage from your book that describes one of his demos, if you could call that. It's an amphibious invasion of one of these beaches. Could you please read from your book there? I think it's page 187.
Yeah, sure. On the ride to the shore, the kids could barely contain their excitement. It would be a 4th of July to remember. As the Long Island Sound came into view, the vans pulled into the boat landing, located next to the private club whose festivities they would soon be crashing. Ned and one of his assistants leapt out of the van and began unfastening the boats from the roof and dropping them into the water. Someone else hung a ladder off the pier. Once everything was in place, Ned and volunteers scurried down the ladder and into the boats. The children strapped on their life jackets, climbed aboard the vessels, and headed out to sea. On the shore, members of the exclusive Madison Beach Club, who underwent a rigorous vetting process and paid a $300 annual membership for days like this, were trickling out onto the beach and planting themselves underneath one of the club's neatly arranged green umbrellas. Just before noon, three boats appeared, all headed toward the club's shore. Ned, with an American flag attached to a pole, leapt off the bow and began marching, MacArthur-esque, toward the beach. Stopping just before he reached the dry sand, he shouted, "Happy 4th of July, everyone," and defiantly planted the flag in the sand. Moments later, a plane began circling overhead, carrying a banner that read, "Free America's Beaches." Club members stared in disbelief. This was an ambush. Parents scooped their children off the beach and made a hasty retreat to the clubhouse.
Sounds like those folks were scared.
Yeah. In a sense, it was kind of unlike anything they'd ever seen before, because, you know, the shoreline in many of these towns had been so effective in limiting public access, and not just limiting public access to the beach, but also sort of limiting diversity within their communities. I mean, one of the things that I talk a lot about in the book is the way that many of these towns had enacted exclusionary zoning ordinances that prevented low-income housing or really sort of prevented anyone below a certain income level from being able to live in these towns. So these were, you know, virtually all white and very sort of class homogenous as well. So the very presence of a busload of children from inner city Hartford was unthinkable for them. The one thing that I think that really sort of stood out to me, especially as someone who had previously studied desegregation of shorelines in the South during the Civil Rights Movement, at a time where there was horrific violence characterized by, you know, efforts to desegregate beaches, you know, wait-ins that took place where mobs of white segregationists would come out into the water with baseball bats and tire irons, and violence would sort of erupt. Here, in these sort of very Tony, you know, well-to-do communities, oftentimes the response was to simply sort of retreat to the clubhouse, remove their children. And that was really one of the saddest things, is that you know, white and black children would be playing together here on the shore, and parents would grab their, you know, their children and sort of take them away as if, you know, that this was some sort of threat to them. At first, they sort of reacted with a degree of shock and then anger and hostility as they realized that Ned wasn't coming there seeking permission. They were coming there as asserting their right to access this beach whenever they pleased.
Now, after a while, of course, there's litigation, and the advocates for freeing the beaches move ahead in many cases in court. What stands out as most significant among those cases?
The protests that Ned Cole and others were waging in Connecticut dovetailed with this open beaches movement, which was really national in scope. And from 1970 to 1980, there were over 150 beach access cases heard in state and local courts. That's up from 10 the previous decade. One of the issues that many of these cases challenged was the right of local communities that had accepted substantial amounts of state and federal tax dollars to help build and enhance their shorelines, whether they could limit access to residents only when it was really everyone who had helped pay for these facilities. Now, the interesting thing that happened in Connecticut was the way that very wealthy towns like Greenwich and Madison interpreted these cases was to say, well, the solution for us is to never accept state or federal tax dollars. And they were wealthy enough that they could do that. And so Greenwich, in particular, developed almost a phobia of any outside funding that was being dangled before them, fearing as if it would be some sort of poison chalice that would then lead them into court.
You're right that when some of these communities were forced to open up their shorelines, quote, to the public, that they found some rather ingenious ways to, and I say that in the diabolical sense of the word, to nonetheless keep people out. Can you give me some examples?
Yeah. So in 2001, the state of Connecticut, the state Supreme Court declared that the restrictions that Greenwich and many other communities were using that explicitly barred non-residents from accessing their shorelines was unconstitutional. So at that point, you know, legally the beaches were open to everyone, but towns were finding new ways to sort of get around this. And so it could either be through very limited parking access or say having parking lots that only residents could park in, selling beach passes in a way that was made it very difficult for non-residents to actually purchase them. But oftentimes, on this issue in particular, there was a real effort to distance, you know, these communities really stressed that their beach access policies had nothing to do with race. It was simply a matter of private property rights, of the rights of local communities to limit access to residents only, and even went so far, oftentimes in a very cynical way, to claim that they were restricting access out of environmental concerns, that they were fearing that if they let anyone onto the shores, then the shores themselves would be harmed.
Oh, I wish I was in the land of come.
Leaders of Dallas, Texas are not sure just how far they want to go in tearing down a Confederate monument. The city got rid of its statue of Robert E. Lee. That seemed automatic after the protest over a Lee statue in Virginia ended with one person killed. But what remains in Dallas is a much larger memorial. The city has wavered over what to do with it, and some of the wavering is among African-American lawmakers. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
Dallas's Confederate monument soars more than 50 feet into the air with a mustache Johnny Reb atop, facing south, of course. At each corner of the base are the four heroes of the lost cause.
Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy. We have Robert E. Lee. We have General Albert Sidney Johnson. And we have General Stonewall Jackson.
John Fullenwider is a medical librarian and, more to the point, a Dallas activist and organizer who's been fighting for years to get the city to take its Confederate memorials down.
This is not a history lesson. This is a celebration of white supremacy that we are demanding be taken down.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Just give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
This is not a history lesson. This is a celebration of white supremacy that we are demanding be taken down.
Last August, that seemed almost a certainty after the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. A month later, the Dallas City Council voted to take down a prominent statue of Robert E. Lee astride his horse. And so Lee and Traveler were carted away. But as the months passed, enthusiasm for further action began to wane. At a contentious public hearing, the mayor and council were attacked as erasers of history and racist against whites. But what was surprising to many was that the 9-6 margin to keep the city's main Confederate memorial up, at least for now, came from 3 out of the 4 black city councilmen. Dwayne Carraway, the mayor pro tem and key African-American council leader, explains why they didn't vote to take down the memorial.
If we had voted that way, then we would lose the game. Yes, the statue would be gone, but what would be there?
Tanel Atkins, another prominent black city councilman who actually brought the motion to defer taking the memorial down, explained, "Everyone in America is watching the city of Dallas and asking, are we doing the right thing?" The third African-American councilman, Casey Thomas, said afterward he wanted a second task force to study whether the memorial should be removed. With their 3 votes, Thomas, Atkins, and Carraway could have brought the Confederate memorial down immediately. So why didn't they? Carraway explains.
The statues, all of that is coming down. But do you have to take down the whole thing? Do we have to start rebuilding from ground up?
What Carraway wants is not completely clear. He would like the Confederate statues gone, but wants to keep the base and perhaps put statues of civil rights icons. But his vote, along with Atkins and Thomas's, has drawn scorn from some of Dallas's most respected black leaders.
No, we were all stunned. We didn't see this coming, and a compromise with white supremacy is a compromise with evil.
Reverend Frederick Haynes III has been the leader of Friendship West Baptist Church with more than 12,000 members for 35 years. The influential pastor was named to the Confederate Monuments Task Force to advise the city. Haynes is flabbergasted that 3 of the 4 black city councilmen voted to keep the memorial up, and he's wary of their explanation that the Confederate statues will come down someday.
The history of Dallas that I thought we were getting over of compromising with people who want to uphold white supremacy, that's been Dallas's history, and as far as I'm concerned, it's plantation politics.
The dominant political player seems to be Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings. Rawlings is a moderate white Southern Democrat who really wants to try to work out a compromise that would keep the Confederate memorial in place while still mollifying anti-Confederate liberals. The mayor readily acknowledges the city's Confederate memorial is a monument to white supremacy, but instead of tearing it down, he wants to make it into a teaching moment, add some sort of historical context that could theoretically balance it all out.
We have an opportunity right here to do something that I think everybody in the city of Dallas could come and see and make us as a city heal. I don't know what it is yet, but I sure am not interested in kind of wiping the slate clean of everything and destroying something that's 122 years old.
The mayor says he wants to think through all of the options, and it's apparent he swayed 3 of the city's black city councilmen to his thinking. But what of the one Dallas African-American councilman who refused to go along? Kevin Felder says he grew up in Gary, Indiana, not Dallas, Texas. He shakes his head in aggravation at his black colleagues' votes and their explanations as to why the statue shouldn't come down right now.
I'm a black man in America, and those Confederate statues are an affront to me and to my culture. The civil rights movement bypassed the city. It didn't bypass the city I was born and raised in.
The conflict over the memorial reveals a city at a political crossroads as it vies for Amazon's second headquarters and reaches for a more progressive vision of itself. Dallas grapples to cut the cords to its white supremacist past. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
At a contentious public hearing, the mayor and council were attacked as erasers of history.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Some high school students are going to learn a little less about world history in coming school years. The College Board has announced that the Advanced Placement World History course will no longer cover pre-colonial civilizations and start from the year 1450, from the arrival of Europeans. But many high school history teachers across the country oppose that change. One of those teachers, Amanda Duamorel, who taught the course for 5 years at a high school in Oakland, California, spoke out at a forum in Salt Lake City.
You cannot tell my black and brown students that their history is not going to be tested and then assume that that's not going to matter.
Amanda Duamorel joins us now from the studios of KUER in Salt Lake City. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
What are your concerns about the effect of this decision?
So as an AP World History teacher, I know that with the way that the exam has been, students have had the opportunity to really dive into content in their deep past, right, and look at things all around the world and draw comparisons through them. And with this change, those things will no longer be assessed, and we're really just cutting down history to about less than 600 years.
Doesn't a good teacher like yourself already have to leave out a lot if you're dealing with 10,000 years of history?
Yeah. I mean, teaching history is a lot about making choices based on what you're teaching and what lens you're teaching it through. But I think what College Board will need to focus on is to really train teachers in how to teach students how to ask big questions and how to, you know, organize the material in thematic ways so that we can understand the context of the world that we live in today, because it's complicated and it includes all people, and we can't just look at it from what's happened in the last 600 years.
What about schools that might say, look, we can offer courses in history that is essentially pre-Columbian, let's say year zero to 1450, and offer the AP course from 1450 to current day?
I think there's value in learning world history over more than 1 year, for sure. My issue right now is the exam itself is only going to cover 1450 to the present. And so whatever you're teaching, students are going to ask, is this going to be on the test? And if it's not, they tune out.
What should we know about that some history courses don't emphasize enough?
One thing is just like I think about Africa. When especially black students learn about African history, a lot of times it just starts at slavery. And something that I got a chance to really learn about in teaching AP World is, you know, the Mali Empire and the riches of the West African nations. And even like someone like Mansa Musa, who's the richest person to ever live. And he was an African king. And that's not something that many students know or many people know. So I think that's just something really cool for students to know and understand, that like those riches were part of their history. Those achievements were part of that.
Amanda Duamorel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? Why genetic annihilation? All these people from Syria coming up in here.
A state lawmaker in Arizona is catching a little bit of heat from his party following some statements he made about how there aren't enough white kids to go around in the state's public schools. This is State Representative David Stringer. Now, I don't want to put words in his mouth. I want to be fair to him. So why don't you hear from him himself? Let's take a look at the video.
60% of public school children in the state of Arizona today are minorities. That complicates racial integration because there aren't enough white kids to go around. But when you look at that 60% number for our public school students, just carry that forward 10 years, 15 years, it's going to change the demographic voting base of this state. And that's what's going on around the country. Immigration is politically destabilizing. President Trump has talked about this. I'm very concerned about this. This immigration today represents an existential threat to the United States. If we don't do something about immigration, very, very soon, the demographics of our country will be irrevocably changed, and we will be a very different country.
I want you to focus on the most important sentence in that rant. Immigration is politically destabilizing. At the end of the day, it always goes back to that. We are the Republican Party. We are racist. We are hateful. People don't usually like to vote for us because of those reasons, unless they look like us. So we need to do something about immigrant kids. We need to do something about immigrants. They're politically destabilizing. That's what it's really... Look, they, of course, think they're inferior, that immigrants are inferior. But more importantly, they're worried about what increased diversity means for them and their political future. That's what they really care about. And by the way, there aren't enough white kids to go around. So what is your solution? There are a lot of immigrants who have become legalized here in the United States. They're going to continue getting married, having kids. They might even mix with white kids. So, like, what's your solution? Like, forced procreation among white couples?
But only whites.
Only whites, yes.
Because there aren't enough white kids to go around. Where are they going? So, he didn't say legal immigrants versus illegal immigrants.
Right.
He said whites. And then he talked about demographics. Mm-hmm. And there's shifting demographics. And then he said it's an existential threat to the United States. Hold on. Let's think about what that means. If the United States is a combination of immigrants, Asians, Latinos, whites, blacks, etc., why would it be an existential threat to the United States? If the sign on the Statue of Liberty is right, give me your poor, your wretched refuse of your teeming shores, etc., why would it be an existential threat? But if your view of the United States is white and only white, then yeah, it is an existential threat to the white United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
Back when you were in charge, because it's not like white people are going away. It's not like they're not having enough sex. It's not like they're not having enough kids. That's actually not an issue. That's an issue in other countries. Is there enough of a birth rate, etc.? That's largely not an issue here. No, what they're saying is we're going to lose political power, and we used to rule over them, and we won't be able to rule over them anymore, and our white supremacy will be lost.
This is the reason why the redistricting happens, gerrymandering happens. This is exactly the reason why states like Ohio are now making it even more difficult for people to vote. They're purging their polls, and the Supreme Court just waited on that and said, absolutely, please go ahead, purge your polls. Okay, story we did earlier this week if you want to look into the details of that. So this, it's always policy that positively impacts the Republican Party. Because they can't win based on the merits of their ideas.
Yeah.
And so they have to rig the system in their favor. And in his mind, this is, hey, immigration, I mean, diversity, that's politically destabilizing to people like me. We need to do something about this. White kids, they need to go around.
All of this is very important, and they're rolling through here. And so I used to think that, hey, white supremacy, that sounds a bit extreme. But it turns out we're in extreme times. They've come out of the closet and they're not hiding it anymore. They're not talking about legal immigrants versus illegal immigrants. In fact, now they're saying we should bar the legal immigrants because of what they call chain migration. That is the primary way that legal immigrants come to this country. They don't want that anymore. Why? Because they're afraid they're going to lose their supremacy. It's real. And they're now just admitting it. So, Anna, did the guy apologize?
Of course he didn't apologize. Look, to the credit of some Republican state lawmakers, they did come out and reject him, which is actually a fresh of breath air in this era because Representative Steve King has been retweeting well-known neo-Nazis, and Republicans on a federal level haven't denounced him, still haven't denounced him. So it's nice to see that some Republican state lawmakers in Arizona have come out and condemned him for these statements. But overall, I mean, the strategy now is to double down on your bigotry. That's what Trump does. He never apologizes, and it's worked out smashingly for him.
And Stringer not only didn't apologize, he said, well, look, the president says similar things. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, that's true. And he said he then started talking about African-Americans and how they're not assimilating.
Doubling down.
Okay, wait a minute. African Americans have been here for centuries. What do you mean they're not assimilating? What does that mean? I don't know what, like, so. I literally don't know what it means. Do you want them to be white? They can't be white. I don't know what you want them to do. It's not like he says, oh, some people aren't, still have accents.
Wait. What do you want them to do about their, why do you care? Why does that bother them so much?
Okay.
What does, but the whole notion of assimilation coming from people like him is beyond insulting. As long as people come here and they follow our rules, follow our laws, they can practice whatever culture they want, as long as they're not breaking any of our laws. I don't care if it makes you uncomfortable. Like, the fact that people with accents make him uncomfortable gives you a sense of who he is and how devastatingly insecure he is as a human being.
He went on to talk about how people that came in the past from Ireland, Sweden, and Norway, etc., did not have accents. But, okay, they had accents in the beginning, you idiot, right? Second of all, people from Ireland speak English. So, poor example. Anyway, he's like, but they don't have accents anymore. Well, okay, then welcome the Latinos that are coming to the country, and they won't have accents in one generation. So, for example, I came when I was 8. I don't have an accent. You must love me, right? My guess is no, you're not going to. Whether it's accents or not accents, you don't love them. And it's because, in his case, he's a proud, apparently, white supremacist.
That's right.
And he's a state representative in the state of Arizona. If you're a Latino or any non-white person that he represents, do you think he's representing you?
Because he sees you as something that's politically destabilizing.
He sees you as a threat to his white supremacy, and he sees you as someone to be commanded and controlled, and not someone to be respected and to represent. He thinks my job is to lord over you, not to represent you. They should vote him out of office as quick as humanly possible.
Get a job! Get a job! Get a job!
Disbelief, and he suddenly was fearing for his safety.
Imagine showing up to work and finding this white-only sign in the office. That's exactly what attorney Corey Bennett, who's based in San Francisco, says happened to his client at Vivint Solar in Sacramento. He's now FaceTiming with us.
It's strange to have to tell a solar company that sunshine is the best disinfectant, but it's pretty clear that Vivint Solar needs to open its doors and look at what's going on inside its warehouses.
Now look at this. It's actually a makeshift fort surrounding the desk. As you can see, the chairs are back here. Now Bennett says his client, Tayshawn Solomon, a father of 4, had had enough.
Throughout his employment, he was referred to with the N-word by white coworkers. He was subjected to gestures, comments, and suggestions that were racist in nature.
According to the official complaint filed in court this week, Solomon was told to reach his black hands out when being handed a box by a non-African-American supervisor who also offered him a banana, saying, "Monkeys like bananas." Solomon resigned.
He really needed this job. He couldn't afford to quit, but he felt like his safety was in jeopardy. I think we'd also like to see the company take this seriously in terms of addressing the personnel who participated in this. You don't just build this white pride playhouse one day unless you've got a real culture problem.
Now, the company released this statement. I want to step out of the shot so you can read it here. They say, we typically have a policy of not commenting on specific personnel matters or pending litigation. However, in this case, we wish to extend a sincere apology to Mr. Solomon for the deeply concerning and understandably upsetting situation he endured. Mr. Solomon's experience was an isolated one, and it has been addressed by our HR team to ensure something like this never happens again. Mr. Solomon's experience simply does not reflect the values or culture of Vivint Solar and stands in direct contradiction to our core values as a company.
Racism is alive in publicly traded companies in the state of California. As progressive and forward-thinking as we like to consider ourselves, it's still there.
When you're a cop, you can torment freely and see me valley, then seize an Audi, then beam proudly to the routine traffic stop to your season finale. When you're a cop, you can shoot a motherfucker by the trailer park. Plenty evidence, sure defense, will be razor sharp. Then turn around and taste a perp, for blazing perp. I'm a cop.
St. Petersburg police officer is off of the job tonight after using a racial slur. The person who first brought up the complaint had just been ticketed by Officer Michael Naples when they exchanged some words. News Channel 8's Jamel Linnae is joining us live tonight from the St. Petersburg Police Department with more on the story. Jamel.
Well, good evening to you, Keith. I can tell you that the man who shot this video says he just couldn't believe that he was called the N-word by an officer. Levante Daniels had his cell phone camera rolling when St. Pete police officer Michael Naples called him the N-word.
Oh, you heard him? You're a piece of
And if you can hear my reaction, I'm completely thrown off by the fact that a police officer to my face just called me in 2018. And that immediately, it upset me to the point where I'm a father. So I have to explain this to my kids in 2018.
Naples resigned this morning after Daniels contacted the department last night and posted the video, which started going viral.
At 1 o'clock this afternoon, Officer Naples resigned from the police department. He would have been fired because we will not tolerate any officers using any type of racial slurs or swearing at a scene or using profanity.
It all started as a disturbance call between Daniels and a pizza delivery driver when Naples showed up and then words were exchanged between Naples and Daniels.
Yeah, I got you recorded.
Chief Anthony Holloway said this type of behavior will not be tolerated from any of his officers.
We always tell the officers, whenever you're on duty, assume that you're being recorded by someone. So, and that's what we expect from officers, to be professional at all times.
And Chief Holloway said that he did speak with Officer Naples, and he said he admitted to using that slur and apologized. He said that Officer Naples was sworn in July of last year, and he had only been on the job for 11 months. Keith?
Jamel Linnae reporting live. Thank you.
Earlier today, L.A. County firefighter Dennis Vineyard was shot and killed battling a blaze at a suspected Compton drug den. We're at the Vineyard home right now, and Lieutenant Vineyard's oldest son, Derek, has agreed to talk with us for a moment. Derek, if you could come down here, please, for just a second. Look, I know this is tough, but how do you feel right now?
How do you think I feel? I think it's typical.
Typical how?
Well, this country's becoming a haven for criminals, so what do you expect? You know, decent, hardworking Americans like my dad are getting rubbed out by social parasites.
Parasites?
Blacks, browns, yellow, whatever.
I don't understand. You're saying that you think maybe your father's murder was race-related?
Yeah, it's race-related. Every problem in this country is race-related, not just crime. It's like immigration, AIDS, welfare. Those are problems of the black community, the Hispanic community, the Asian community. They're not white problems.
Derek, aren't those really issues that deal more with poverty?
No, you know, no. They're not products of their environments either. That's crap. Minorities don't give two shits about this country. They come here to exploit it, not to embrace it.
What does this have to
do? I mean, millions of white European Americans came here and flourished, you know, within a generation. So what the fuck is the matter with these people? They have to go around shooting at firemen.
What does this have to do with the murder of your father?
Because my father was murdered doing his job, putting out a fire in a fucking nigger neighborhood he shouldn't have even given a shit about. He got shot by a fucking drug dealer who probably still collects a welfare check.
A brawl in the Bronx involving some of New York's bravest. Cell phone video shows a group of off-duty uniformed firefighters behaving badly. It happened Wednesday night in the concourse section not far from Yankee Stadium. Witnesses say some of the firefighters appeared drunk. Police responded, but no one was arrested. The video has been handed over to the city's Department of Investigation. Meanwhile, Fire Commissioner Daniel Nigro says anyone who was engaging in that behavior will be held accountable.
World nigga law.
Here in Britain, commemorations have been taking place for the 72 victims of the Grenfell Tower fire in London a year ago today. Bishop of Kensington, the Right Reverend Graham Tomlin, addressed the service of remembrance at St Helen's Church.
We pray that Grenfell Tower would turn from a symbol of pain
and loss, a symbol of our failure to care for one another, into a symbol of change and renewal. We long for Grenfell Tower in 10, 20 years' time to be a symbol of a time we learnt to live differently, where no community had to grieve as this one has done.
The 24-storey apartment block housed families from a host of countries in one of the richest boroughs of London. An official inquiry into the disaster has heard evidence of a series of catastrophic safety failures. Hundreds of survivors were made homeless and left traumatised by the blaze, the worst in Britain since World War II. The BBC's Claire McDonnell was at the tower block this morning.
Well, the mood here is incredibly sombre. It's very reflective as well. Grenfell Tower is now wrapped in a plastic sheath, but with the green love heart at the top of it, which has become a symbol of remembrance for Grenfell and the 72 people who lost their lives. And it was actually lit up in a green light at 1:06 this morning. That was the time the fire service received the first call, and the names of all 72 victims were read out at a memorial at the local church at 1:30 a.m. this morning. But there is, it has to be said, Ollie, there is anger too. The plastic wrapping that went, that is wrapping and encasing the tower at the moment, only went up in the last week. And many people who live locally and lost loved ones say having this, what is in effect a charred tomb, towering above them from the last year, has made day-to-day life even harder. Of course, the public inquiry started a few weeks ago. We've had very powerful witness statements. But for families that this tragedy touched across the world, so many people living in that tower came to London from the four corners of the world. One of those who died was 79-year-old Kamru Mia, who became trapped in his home on the 17th floor, along with his first wife, Rabea, his two sons, both called Mohammed, and his daughter, Husna. As the harrowing details of the family's last desperate phone calls to friends and loved ones began to emerge thousands of kilometres away in the Bangladeshi town of Mulvi Bazar, another family would be left shattered.
That night, I came from mosque after prayer and went to sleep. My cousin, Abdul Rahim, called me from London and told me Suzanne's uncle's house has caught fire. Pray for him. Abdul went to the building, and my father was screaming on the phone, Abdul Rahim, save me, save me. But there was nowhere to save him. Then my cousin called again and told me there is no hope. My father used to visit Bangladesh every 1 or 2 years. He always brought clothes for us and chocolate for his grandchild. He always sent money to us. Without it, we would not have been able to build this house. This is 1 year now. We have organized a prayer ceremony, and we will feed the poor in his memory.
Kamru Mia's son, Hakim, talking to the BBC from Bangladesh. Well, for over 27 years, Antonio Roncalato lived in Grenfell Tower. Dan Damon has been speaking to him about the night of the fire a year ago.
I was on the 10th floor. I was in bed. My son, Christopher, was coming home around 1:40 a.m. And he realized that the tower was burning, was ablaze. And he called me straight away. And he said, Father, Father, get out of there as quickly as possible because the tower is burning, literally burning. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, yes, yes, get out now, get out now. So basically, I got up, I assessed a little bit the situation, went to the living room, to the kitchen, and I realized that there was so many noises, so many police outside, sirens from fire brigades and so on. So shortly after, Christopher sent me a photo that he took of the tower burning. And when I saw it, I opened it and I realized, oh my God, it's a really big thing here. So I'm in trouble.
And you realized that you couldn't get out, the smoke was too thick, but you got conflicting advice, didn't you? Some people said, get out, and some people said, stay.
Yes, yes. Well, basically the people outside, or the crowd gathering outside, they would tell me, get out, get out. But I was constantly on the phone with Christopher, and maybe the second or third phone call that I had with him, he passed me to a fire marshal, and so I explained to him, you know, where I was, and he told me, okay, stay put, mate, because somebody's coming to get you. And he told me, the fire is not right next to you, it's on the other side of the tower. We know you're there, we're coming to get you, stay there. And I said, okay. However, when I assessed the situation, the smoke was extremely thick, extremely hot, very acrid. It was really very, very risky to go out. And I picture myself trying to escape. And I was thinking, you know, you cannot see anything. You cannot be able to breathe. What if you inhale so much smoke and you lose your senses? You trip over. So I decided to follow the instruction and to stay put.
And did somebody come to get you?
Yes, yes. Well, during that night, then many things happened, you know, like there was smoke coming in into my flat through the windows. The smoke detector went off, making a lot of noise. And then I received a lot of calls from friends and family and colleagues from work, you know, trying to find out what was going on and trying to tell me, you know, what to do or not to do. And to a point where I decided, okay, hold on, they don't know exactly, you know, what I'm experiencing here. So I better reject all the calls from now on. Also because I wanted to keep the line open for my son, for Christopher, to, you know, to give me information and to keep a line open for him. And then finally, at around 6 o'clock, after, you know, another call with Christopher, he passed me on to a fire marshal and he told me, we're coming to get you now, just be ready, somebody's coming to get you now. And really, a few minutes after, two firemen, they came, they knocked at the door, I opened them. And I was ready with my rucksack, my passport, Christopher's passport, document, laptop, my watches and everything. So important things that I could put together. And basically, I was ready to go. And they told me, are you ready? I said, yes. Okay, then let's go. And they put a wet, a totally wet towel on my head. And I had a small towel also in my hand and in my mouth. So to try to filter the air a little bit. And I followed them. I was holding on the jacket on the fireman in front of me. The fireman behind me was protecting me. And we went down very well synchronized down the stairwell. And within two and a half minutes, we came down. And during this little short journey, a lot of water would come onto my head. And a lot of water, a lot of rubbish, a lot of debris would fill in the, you know, on the floor as we walked down. We reached the lower part of the tower, then I could hear noises from people downstairs, basically, you know, fire brigades and police. And basically then the moment, you know, we reached the ground floor, I got rid of the towel from my head and I was escorted to a safe place where I was then after taken to hospital.
A former resident in Grenfell Tower, Antonio Roncalato.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 16th, 2018. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, suggestions, observations, anything to share on the audio segments we just heard. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things to share. We'll try to see if I can get everything in. First and foremost, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, look in the top right corner. You will see the PayPal button. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we'll get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all of the listeners who have invested nearly a decade in the context of white supremacy has been broadcasting. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Also, you can invest if you want to nab an item from Gus's wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. I'll post it on my social media sites during the broadcast. Again, tremendous thanks to all the listeners who've nabbed items from my wish list over the years. It has been immensely helpful. I hope the cows has helped non-white listeners get an accurate understanding of white supremacy, racism, things, suggestions, things we could do to help replace white supremacy with justice immediately. And certainly you can always invest in the cows by sharing the content, post the links on your social media page. If you think it would benefit other victims of racism to know about the live broadcast happening right now or any of the other broadcasts we've done. Next, counter-racist t-shirts. Dr. Trav informed me within the last 48 hours that all of the t-shirts, orders that he has received thus far, have been mailed. So I would think at maximum by the end of next week, thinking the 22nd of June, by the 22nd, if you have already ordered a t-shirt, you should have it. I am excited. I am looking forward. And anyone who has, if we have listeners who've been able to tolerate Gus T for that long, any of the folks who have the t-shirt that says, please respect me like a white person, I am curious if you note a difference in how people respond to the please treat me like a white person, if there's a difference at all or if it's exactly the same. That would be interesting. I'm looking forward to hearing that. If you could write up your responses, you can make it a blog post, YouTube video, whatever, audio recording, anything you can think of. If you want to email it in, I can read it on the air, but just how people respond to you wearing the shirt, I would be very interested in hearing, and I'm sure listeners would as well. I just said, I think people, if you listened to the Workplace Racism broadcast this past week, or the book club, Invisible Man, yesterday, I was with a black female, good pal of mine. She gave birth to her second child, a natural childbirth, second time around. And wow, to be there literally like in the same room while the process was happening, like, wow. I do not have children. After all of that, I am thankful. I do not have children. Wow. Woof. I'm so thankful. She had a little girl. Everybody's healthy. Amazing. Was, you know, so thankful for that. But wow, I do not have children. Tomorrow's Father's Day. Woof. I'm glad. Missed out on all of that. Woof. So many things just observing that process and, you know, man, while the mother, black mom, was giving birth, I was holding her 1-year-old. Literally, we're walking around the center with the child's uncle. We're walking around and waiting, you know, for the birth process to complete. And how Gus T, misanthrope that I am, curmudgeon, even ended up, you know, being this close for such an intimate moment. Everyone present, dad, mom, uncle, everyone present, not only is familiar with counter-racism, everyone present has participated in the cows, and I think two of the three have read Mr. Fuller's work and Dr. Welsing's work. That's how Gus T ended up being there. At any rate, so I'm with uncle and 1-year-old, and he and I, so many times, ashe to the grandcestor, the brilliant third-generation physician, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, who said all the time, no closer than 2 years apart. No closer than 2 years apart. No closer than 2 years apart. Oh my goodness. So many times we just acknowledged and had immense reverence for the brand. I mean, really, I mean, it is a total difference in having someone say that and then, oh, this is having children closer than 2 years apart. This is what that experience. Whew. The brilliance of Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing. Whew. And I think the mom, because we did talk about this, I think she would co-sign like 50,000 times the brilliance of Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing, no closer than 2 years apart. Anywho, the segment on, and again, maximum gratitude, mom, child, super healthy, right on, natural childbirth. The segment on the New York Fire Department brawl did not include enough information. The New York Daily News has additional commentary that I'm going to add just to make sure that there's no confusion. There are so many incidents of fire department terrorism. So many. A retired firefighter. He can comment on that. But there have been so many instances, and we've done this before, I think, just had like a collage of incidents of race soldier firefighters terrorizing black people in a variety of ways. But I do use the segment from the movie American History X, where Ed Norton's character, white child, is complaining that his white racist father has been killed by some crackhead niggers, and his dad shouldn't have been there even putting out the fire in this crack house anyway. That's from a movie, even though it sounds like a news interview, just to make sure that there's no confusion. And I know everyone has not seen the film American History X. You don't need to see it. But I do use that sound clip just because, you know, there's the racism in the fire department is so rampant, and they excuse it or justify it in a variety of ways. The segment that you heard about this brawl with off-duty New York firefighters, the New York Daily News writes, several fire companies had rented out Billy's Bar. Some moron says sobriety would be best. Continuing, rented out Billy's Bar on June 6th to celebrate following the ceremonies where Fire Department of New York Commissioner Daniel Nigro, N-I-G-R-O, Negro, I'm not sure, and Mayor Bill de Blasio, Cowbell, honored the smoke eaters. Fists started flying, sources said, following a day of boozing when a member of Rescue 3 called a firefighter from Engine 68 a nigger. So just based on the information that I have, the video that I saw, it seems like, if I'm reading this correctly, a white firefighter called another black firefighter a nigger after they had been drinking, hanging out with Bill de Blasio. Don't know if his non-white wife and non-white children were present, allegedly celebrating the good deeds of the smoke eaters. And then fisticuffs ensue. Sobriety, I don't know, this might even just be workplace racism. Some moron does talk a lot about not going to office parties and being really careful. I think the worst combination in the known universe, whites and alcohol. That's how he says it. Moron, that's how he says it though. Wow, they left that out. That happens consistently in reports. Racism, white supremacy, you're going to get all the details. And these jokers just got suspended, not fired, still on the job. If you live in the New York area, Thomas, Roz, many folks, longtime listeners, black female caller in New York, many of them, these might be the folks that show up if you have a problem, or even they get called on rescue. Sometimes it's not even a fire. It could be a medical emergency. And sometimes these are the personnel who show up. New York's finest, as they say. Next, Dallas. I've been to Dallas. We've always had a good number of listeners in the Texas area, the Cows. The segment talking about the Confederate monuments. When the white person said that this monument is a celebration of white supremacy. That, for me, keep it up forever. I would be right there protesting with the race soldiers. Don't take it down. Keep it up forever. And just make sure you have a little plaque that says celebration of white. Make it plain so it's no confusion. This is what we have. This is what exists. This is what we are trying to get right. We can take it down when the system of white supremacy has been eliminated. But until then, let's keep it up. That's been my attitude about all of this. Anyway, in that segment, super important. In that segment, they made it seem, NPR, that it's the black people's fault, the black council members, all three of them, that this Confederate monument was not removed. Somehow, in a system that is celebrating, where white supremacy is celebrated, it is three Negroes' fault that this statue couldn't be removed in Dallas, Texas, of all places. The typical response, if you don't understand the system of white supremacy, you get upset. Man, these coon Uncle Tom Sambo handkerchief head will lynch them right now. You go crazy. You name call, you put them right up there with Sheriff Clark. Who else is it? President Obama. You put them right up there and name call and whoa. The most important sentence in the whole report. The dominant political player seems to be Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings, classified as white, who swayed. This would be the person to blame. And in fact, I don't know if they, maybe I was thinking the whole time, I don't know if they got compensated. Who knows? Mr. Rawlings could have came up and told them, he could have got gangster with them. Like, hey, this is what it's going to be. That might be a metaphor. He could have came up and got really explicit. Like, hey, this is what it's going to be, gentlemen. You're going to vote to keep that statue up. And that's what it's going to be. Now, you can say whatever you want to justify, give them whatever reasons you want. But at the end of the day, your vote had better be those monuments are going to stay put. And that's that. It could have been that. It could have been, hey, we'll, you know, give you a vacation. We'll give you a certain amount of money. We won't lock your child up. Anything. The system of it's easy for race soldiers to sway Negroes in the system of white supremacy. But the easy thing, what racists depend on, is that we will get mad at those three black council members. I'm not even saying their name because they're not important. We should be focused on Mayor Mr. Rawlings. Why did you feel the need to sway these Negroes to keep this monument up? Great question. Continuing. The Pittsburgh Natural Hair Group, I listened to that and I said, man, I would have used my rewind button. They started out a segment on black people and natural hair, and a white woman took over the segment who has abducted a black child. Again, the system of white supremacy. And I sat in awe. Not that I was surprised, but just in awe. Again, the power. White women. They got Donald Trump to the White House. Do not ever minimize the power of the white woman to take over, colonize, if you will, a segment that was ostensibly supposed to be about black people not chemically damaging their hair to conform to white supremacy beauty standards. Pam, interracial con game and the beauty con game. Trojan Horse Publications. Pam, always appreciate her efforts. Next, Dr. Wasayan was with us on the program this past week. He encouraged Gus to check out the there's a movie and there's a TV series, Black Lightning. I got confused. It's been a full week. Lots happening. I thought maybe the 2018 TV show, maybe that's what he was talking about because that's newer. I said, okay, and this was, I think, based on him hearing me say that any content like movies, television programs that have a lot of black people, I don't want to see. I've had my fill of Empire, which I've never seen, and New Jack City, all of the Power, which I've never seen. The Butler, which I've never seen. Precious, which I unfortunately did see 45 minutes of. I've had my fill. Black Panther, which I've never seen. Do not intend to see. If it's got a lot of black people in it, I'm not going to watch it. So he said, watch Black Lightning. And every time I see one of these films with a lot of black people in it and it confirms the stance that I've taken, it just ratchets up where I'm less and less likely. If it's got a lot of black people in it, I'm not watching it. So I watched the first 10 minutes of Black Lightning. I sit down to see what this is going to be. I already have very low expectations. And so within the first 5 minutes, we got a black person getting stopped by the police. I'm not interested in seeing that. We've seen that 50,000. Didn't we see Boys in the Hood? We saw that, right? I'm not even interested in seeing this. Okay, black person get pulled over by the police. I think there was already a riot about some sort of police shooting or what have you, the Hate U Give. We've already seen that. Okay, get through all that. There's a club scene. Luke Cage, I endured the horror, the trauma of Marvel's Luke Cage, another reason why I'm not watching Black Panther ever. They get through the club scene, which is filled with anti-blackness and bad acting. There's a lewd sexual scene between a black male and a black female. They go upstairs. A black male threatens a black male, commits violence against a black male in front of a black female. And then the black female, this was the point where I could take no more. The black female says, oh, I didn't know that you were this person's B-word. And she knees the black male in the groin. Once again, if the content has a lot of black people in it, I am not going to watch it. That's not an indictment of black people or even black people that attempt to do television content, movie content, if anything. It is my observation, the system of white supremacy, they are at work. Strongest to me, it seems, when there are no whites on the screen. I mean, the anti-blackness content saturation is most intense when you have a lot of black people on the screen. We're going to make sure that this is really intensely destroying black self-respect. Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing, once again. Do I have enough? Can I do this in 5 minutes? I think I can get this in 5 minutes. I can do this in 5 minutes. I could talk yoga stories for a long, long time. I had mentioned before, lovely, flexible black female. We went to the park, had ice cream. She wanted to walk me home. We chatted about racism. She made comments that to me suggested might be white identified. She probably has white friends. Not sure how much of that, you know, I can be patient about. I go to yoga class this week, go to restorative yoga class, which I don't even take very many of. I get there. Lovely, flexible black female is present. Wowee. I'm super excited. I go in. I take 2 steps, literally. Uh-oh. She's in conversation with a white man. I immediately think, oh, maybe she just sat randomly and he asked her a question. That does happen sometimes where you just sit down. In fact, even in some classes, they will tell you, speak to the person next to you. I've been in quite a few classes where they say that. Generally, I even ignore that prompt. I'll just stay on my back. And so then because I'm always next to a white person when they do this. So when the suspected racist, when they turn, if they do even turn, because a lot of times they don't even turn, they're just like, ugh, Negro sitting next to me, I'm not even going to turn and greet. That has happened quite a few times. But sometimes I'll be on my back and they'll turn and, you know, I don't even participate in that. Anyway, I was thinking, you know, maybe this was a random pairing, who knows, but the conversation lasted a little too long to be a random, you know, strangers just happened to be here and we're going to carry on a 5-minute dialogue before a yoga class. I could be making an incorrect assessment. I go sit down, lovely class, fantastic, feeling great. Afterwards, I say, you know, I'll go talk because maybe that's, you know, she doesn't even know him. Don't want to jump. Don't want to make assumptions. Very important. I go to talk and it was as if the race soldier was picking up my vibration and stopped. I was like, oh, I'm going to go back and wait for her. It's like, oh, ouch, ouch. We have taken critical losses in 2018, the flood, It has been tough. I did think I should send her Pam once again, racismws.com. I thought within about 30 seconds, ooh, I should make sure I send her information, interracial con game, get another plug, interracial con game. I should send her the review for the interracial con game just to give her information, because I process that as danger, even if they're just like, quote unquote, friends. Danger if you are around this individual and you do not classify, think of this person as a racist. There's no such thing as white people that are not racist. I think, yes, I will send her information on Pam's work. I said I will wait a little bit so it doesn't come across like I'm just being spiteful about it. I view it as life-saving information, like even if it's something that she thinks about a year later, is able to think about a year later, like, wow, this is really important. I don't even remember that nigger's name, but this is valuable information, the interracial con game. I'm so glad I read this. I'll never look at whites again. That's what the goal is. That is what the goal is. So I'm thinking I'm going to send her a link. We'll report back if I get any constructive or even non-constructive feedback, if I get any sort of hostility, which I hope doesn't happen. I haven't heard that too often from folks, but I'm going to forward the information. With that, I still had other things, but we'll have to leave it there. The number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you could take 5 minutes, whatever commentary you would like to share, that would be grand. That just makes sure everyone gets an opportunity to speak. If you have additional comments or questions, if you could wait until everyone has shared once, and then I'm sure we'll have ample time to include your additional commentary. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Helps preserve the quality of the broadcast so people don't have to fight over a lot of unnecessary background noise. For this broadcast, if we could not use metaphors, very important. We are supposed to be mindful about what we say and not just go into dialogue about white supremacy, just saying anything, using any terms. Racists, they frequently deliberately employ metaphors, similes, analogies, comparisons in a deceptive manner. They will compare and contrast two separate entities and insist that these two things are identical. Frequently, that is not the case at all, and it is the tactic of a master deceiver, master racist. Victims of white supremacy, including Gus T, we've been exposed to this behavior for a long time, and many of us are still learning. Thus, we have not come to conclusions on certain subjects, and so sometimes, instead of logic, we will insert metaphors, similes, and often that just contributes to a lot of confusion. If we could be direct, explicit about what it is we'd like to say, that would be great. If you need a little additional time to think, to get the correct words together, that is acceptable, encouraged even. With that, folks who dialed in with a hand up, star 61, if you haven't, or the first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Everyone waiting, folks with hands up. Yes, ma'am. Red in Nevada.
Hello. Thank you for allowing me to share. Hello, everyone. Doing right poorly, but definitely appreciate the clips. The first thing I wanted to speak about was the swimming pool segment where the, I guess it was the interviewer, he had used the term ingenious as far as the white, the racist white communities around the shoreline being using ingenious ways to still keep, to still practice racism and keep black children out of the swimming area or away from their beaches. And then he kind of fixed and he said, well, you know, this ingenious, but kind of like in a bad way. And it reminded me of, there was a segment, you know, in the past where basically it was like that same thing where it's like, oh, well, this is a, you know, this is a really great way. I think it was, when I commented about it, it was, I said, you know, you could always use the term infamous, you know, it's still, it's a really, it's something that is really popular, but it's popular for a bad thing, or it's a strategic, but in a bad way. So it's like I feel like they do these things on purpose. And then also I was just thinking about like just their use of words. Maybe when it comes to, if there are white people who are listening to that type of segment or even listening to other news clips and things of that nature, where they use these type of words like ingenious when it comes to describing other groups of white people practicing racism, I think that they can get, you know, these are learning lessons for them. You know, if you could still get state money and still be able to practice racism against the people who are actually paying taxes there. And the other thing, the other note, the commentary about, I can't stand the Young Turks, but I appreciate you, you know, playing their segments, because I know when I was more confused, I still did not like them, but there were other non-white people around me who thought that they were non-racist white people. They might even use the term progressive or quote unquote liberal. But, you know, just the term, just them wanting to be fair. I think it was a white female who said they wanted to be fair and let him use, basically trying to use his own words against them, which again, it seems like this doesn't seem like this, the only fairness that they were applying is that let me make sure to allow other white people who are racist to hear this racist word, so maybe they can get ideas. This is not, I don't think that it was something that, you know, it was for, I guess, fairness to be in the sense of being good. And also they said that there were other Republicans who rejected Stringer, his comments, but that means nothing. I don't know what rejected means if they're not also putting together some type of, I don't know, like, I don't think it's like impeachment, but whatever type of process it is to get him out of office. All they said was, oh, I just reject that. That means nothing. That's no more than, you know, these different diversity trainings. The AP, and then the comment on the AP class segment, just, I know that the black female victim of racism, BGQ, of course, but it's like she had made it the reference of, you know, well, black and brown students aren't really learning about their history. Who exactly is brown? Because again, these people who may not have, who may speak Spanish, but there's no classification. What are the qualifications of these people being brown? It seems like sometimes these people may be brown when with other white people, when they don't want to include them into their benefits of practicing racism, but then any other time these people are classified as white. The last thing I wanted to share is just one brief thing about Nevada and, of course, the opioid epidemic. There was an article that came out this week in the Las Vegas Review Journal, and it was about the senator. I don't have the article in front of me, unfortunately, but he is just talking about how he was able to get state grant money to start installing disposal units at different Walgreens around Las Vegas, so that way these pills that people no longer need can get disposed of properly. And he made mention of, well, so that way they don't just get up getting flushed down the toilet and somehow getting recycled into the water supply or to getting into the hands of addicts and causing more harm. So just another way of how these people are able to use other people's money to help white people. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Save white people. One quick comment I did want to make. Thank you for sharing, Red in Nevada. That segment about the racist conduct on the Connecticut beaches, I paid particular attention to that segment because the person being interviewed was Andrew Carl. He's been on The Cows. We talked about his previous book, The Land Was Ours, which is the same subject, how whites, what he talked about in the segment, how they terrorize black people, particularly with waterfront property. Lots of constructive information. I thought he was 2015 when he was a guest on the program. And he went to my alma mater, University of Virginia, which was in the news this week. I could have included them, Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings, Cowbell. But I paid attention in that segment. The word was imaginative, I think, that the race soldiers got very imaginative with their schemes for excluding niggers from the Connecticut beaches. And he said it was imaginative, but in a diabolical sense, I think, was the way he phrased it. And I, too, thought that was very curious, a very curious way of phrasing white terrorism. Yeah, I picked up on the same thing. Other folks who dialed in.
Can I hear?
Mr. Steele, good to hear from you.
Awesome. Yeah, just real quick. You know, I love the Pacific Coast. I love driving up and down the Pacific Coast Highway and some of the little streets that are very local to the area, but very close to the shoreline. And I oftentimes like to go on some of these little parks that are set along the Pacific Coast. I mean, there's some really beautiful parks. And some of them are set inside communities that when I'm driving in them, especially if I'm driving a non-luxury automobile, I really get nervous because even though they say state beach or public park, state park, all of this information that, you know, denotes that it's public, I get the feeling that the people around it, and I definitely feel like I'm encroaching on their space whenever they're present. You know, if it's early in the morning, if, you know, some of them are jogging, or if I see a suspected racist later in the day, you know, just enjoying the view as I am. I just, there's a very strong twinge of, or a strong feeling that I get that I have to leave, or I have to at least be very mindful of my surroundings. And, you know, these would be otherwise beautiful and, you know, breathtaking scenery, you know, just, you know, very serene experiences. But for the presence of the local suspected racist, I mean, it just, even though these are very low policed areas, it just makes me very nervous. And I also am very cognizant that it would be a problem if I brought, it would be okay, I think, if I brought my family there, if I, you know, if it was clearly my family, but if I brought, say, my boys, like if I brought my, if I rolled in with a crew, no, we would get called, police would be called, we would be investigated. And so as a result, these are experiences that I often have by myself. And it's very rare that I get to share that, with, you know, other victims, because of this, it, of this very, strange feeling that I get from these areas. So, yeah, it was very interesting hearing that report. And I don't think that the feeling that I get in those areas is by accident. I think it's very deliberate. And I think it's pretty insidious how they managed to do it with such little, I mean, there's a sign. Maybe it's the sign that makes me feel that way. Or maybe just how well it's manicured. It's just all of these things make me go, man, I don't think I'm allowed here. and also, I wanted to remark, speaking of white women, and speaking of white women who are in interracial relationships, a cowbell relationship, the former CEO of a company called Theranos was recently indicted on criminal charges of fraud. And I did some investigation into this because I had heard rumblings of this, and you know, I had heard that there was you know, she had been barred from participating in publicly traded companies or something like that. Some very weak results to her charges or fraud, and I was just waiting for the criminal charges to come down, and they finally did come down. And there's been a lot of very interesting profiles. I just went back in the videos, and I noticed that she employed a very, very, very scary, I'm going to use the word scary, techniques to, I guess, hypnotize people when she was talking to them. She had big blue blonde, big blue eyes, blonde hair, and she would open her eyes and not blink as she spoke with you. And then she even went as far as to simulating a deeper voice, a huskier voice, that was several octaves lower than most men that you would talk to. And it's just very strange listening to her interviews. She very closely resembles Mark Zuckerberg, actually. It's very uncanny how much they look alike. I think it would be very interesting to study just how effective white women are at scamming money using vehicles such as corporations and, more commonly, nonprofit organizations. I think that is worth investigating, and that's worth studying. And I'll go ahead and mute my line. Thank you so much.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. Certain I would agree. study. Mr. Fuller advised that studying white people, white women in particular. Other folks we've not heard from at all. Folks with a hand up are lollygagging, it seems. Let's see.
Oh, can I share?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Oh, I'll go ahead and let the lady go first.
Oh, thank you. I didn't hear you speak up, or else I would have yielded the floor, but thank you very much. This is the Codified Software Developer from Wisconsin. I just wanted to chime back in on last night when Ivy and Red called me Codified Software Developer. I don't mind that, actually. I actually like it, so I might start using it myself. Also, in terms of the Black Hair Care segment, the first segment that you played, I was at Six Flags Great America today and noticed quite a few non-white female children with white male adults. And this was very concerning for a lot of reasons. And I just noticed some inappropriate behavior between these white male adults and these non-white female children, especially those that are in the teen age. And it was just very disconcerting. I realized that these children are victims, and quite honestly, extremely victimized in these positions. So that's all I really had. Thank you. Oh, actually, I have one more thing. I was speaking to, this is about the book club again as well. I was speaking to a victim who was talking, I was talking about the book club, the Cows Book Club, and I was speaking to another victim. And she stated that Ralph Ellison had written a second book, which I'm not aware of. I thought that he had he was writing a second book, but there was a house fire and it burned up. And I just wanted to ask the listeners, ask you, Gus, and ask the listeners if you are aware of a second book that is supposed to be a sequel to Invisible Man. And thank you so much. I'm sorry I didn't greet everybody appropriately. Hi, Gus. Hi, callers and listeners. And thank you. I'll mute my line.
Greetings, codified software developer. Juneteenth is also published by Ralph Ellison, but it was published posthumously. They gathered those drafts. That was the book that he had the house fire and lost a significant number of pages and continued writing and editing up to his death. And then they took those pages and published Juneteenth. So that is book number two. It is available. It's been out for, I think, at least 10 years, maybe even longer than that. The mail caller who yielded the floor, much obliged.
Yeah, this is Sharkbait. I just wanted to comment on a couple segments. First, I'd like to say to Mr. Steele, yeah, be careful around those beaches because I live in the Southern California area and I grew up surfing, black surfer, if there's such a thing. But yeah, it's when I go to the beach and I feel the same way too. So when I go, I just get in the water to get my exercise and my relaxation and get change and get out of there. Because the sheriffs will mess with you, and you will get harassed. But I want to also make a comment on the beach access. Santa Monica, in Santa Monica, California, there's a place called the Inkwell Beach, and they dedicated a plaque to that section of the beach in Santa Monica on Bay Street that it used to be specifically for black people, and that's the only section of the beach we can go to during that. During, I think, the 50s and 60s. So if you're coming from, like, South Central or whatever to go to the beach, that's where we got to go. And there's, like, a little plaque. If you Google Inkwell Santa Monica, they have pictures of a little plaque that's dedicated to that section of the beach. And also, too, another segment on resigning versus termination. When you talk about law enforcement, when law enforcement resign, just like you always say, Gus, white people always get transferred. When you resign from a job, especially if you're in a job where you work for like a county or the city, when you resign, you get your pension and your retirement still versus being terminated. Because that's something I learned because as a background investigator, I also work with internal investigations and we kind of talk about stuff. So, for example, after I do 25 years, I can get 100% medical retirement. But if I do something wrong and I'm under investigation and they terminate me, I will not get my medical. And then they also have a matching program where my job, they match like 3%. They put 3% into your 401k, your retirement, and then you can just put whatever else you want into it up to 6%. So like if I get terminated, that 3% that they've been putting in with interest, they'll take out. And that's kind of like a difference. So when you see all these race soldier law enforcement officials resigning, they're more than likely, like anything else, they're letting them resign so they can keep their little retirement stuff there that they're getting instead of terminating, where I see a lot of black officers or whatever, they get terminated. And just another little thing I observed, because as I said, I'm a water person. So I paddleboard a lot. And so today I went paddleboarding with my three offspring. So as we were paddleboarding, my oldest has her own paddleboard and my two younger ones, I put on my paddleboard. I don't know if anyone knows what paddleboarding is. Like, it's almost like a surfboard, but you stand up with like an oar type of thing and you paddle around. So as we were paddling by a white lady, she's about 50. And then I guess it was her daughter who was about 23. You know, they said hello. So I acknowledged them and said morning back. And then as we're passing them by, they're like, look, I have on my board, I had my 6-year-old and my 3-year-old. And they're like, look, you have two lazy people who don't want to do anything. And I'm looking at, and I was just like, and I was just laughing. So that's just something that's tacky. That's always done. Every time I go to the beach or take my kids just enjoy nature, always something tacky happens when they see black people out trying to enjoy themselves in the sun. That's all I want to share.
Wow. Confirmation. I think Thomas in New York talked about that, being able to remain composed in those moments and not get angry. It just confirms what we talk about on this broadcast, what others, Dr. Bobby E. Wright, Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing have been talking about and the problem we're trying to correct. It's not, wow, that is a responsible black father. We should have more of the happy Father's Day. He's taking his children out to get some exercise in the sunshine, enjoy the California. Bravo. Bravo. No, it's we got two lazy niggers out here who don't. Wow. Sit the white woman on display. Other folks we have not heard from at all. If you have a hand up.
Maybe here.
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners on the line. If I could just have 1 second to pull up my notes, which I already did. Okay, so first thing I want to say, thank you so much, Gus, for telling me not to say kill and not to employ that metaphor playfully. I should have said have mercy instead, and I'm going to work at eliminating that word as a metaphor, because, you know, to be playful or whatnot, because that's not something to play with, especially referring to black people killing other black people. I wanted to say, as far as the previous caller, what he said about the black surfer, man, you don't have to worry about that. I wouldn't be surprised if we invented surfing, just like we did with hockey and rock and roll and a bunch of other stuff that white people stole and said that it was theirs. As far as the inkwell, I didn't know that. In California, I wonder if that is what inspired the movie The Inkwell, with, I believe it was Lorenz Tate. As far as the clips, you would never know it from what I did tonight, but I am getting a whole lot better at just being able to take the verbal abuse that white people perpetrate when they report on things. And it was so unprofessional and so terroristic and so tacky, and it actually shocked me. It shouldn't have, but it did. With the clip, when that lady said, when that race soldier said something about black women getting the natural kinks out of their hair, because that was an insult. I was about to employ a metaphor. That was an insult, and it shocked me, because it was so unprofessional, and it was just, to me, it was so blatantly insulting. And it's like, you talk about natural kinks. No, we don't have kinks, like Dr. Welsing said. No, we have tangles, just like you have tangles. The difference is we have thick hair with tangles and you have thin hair with tangles, but you nonetheless still need assistance to get your tangles out using what is called detangler. I wanted to say to, let me see, let me make sure. Okay, yes. So I wanted to speak to the codified software developer. First of all, I want to thank you for your encouragement about the dog food epidemic language that I use. I'm really encouraged by that, and, you know, and you're welcome, and, you know, thank you so much for your encouragement with that. I have a question for you as well as everyone on the line, including Gus. Where I mess up at is, like, with white people, where they could get me, because as I've said many times, I'm very emotional, and it in a variety of ways, probably in all of ways, in all ways. When I feel something, I really feel it, whether I'm sad or I'm angry, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So people can really play on my emotions, but especially white people, because they're master deceivers. And how they get me a lot of times is when they're really nice. And I noticed that I was feeling positive emotions that I was trying to resist. Not too long ago at that luncheon that I spoke about in the past, toward not the race soldier, but her daughter. But I was trying to resist that. And what that has to do with the codified software developer is this. When that white man, that white male, who you said is of use to you because he gives you constructive information, and he told you to watch out when that race soldier was trying to kill you, in my view, I'm having to fight through positive emotions that I feel toward him because I felt like he saved your life. And so my question is, do you have positive emotions toward him for the, you know, looking out or telling you to watch out when you were almost going to get hit and when he just gives you all of this constructive information? And if you don't have positive emotions as a result of these things, how do you maintain psychological and emotional distance from white people when they are nice to you? That's a question for you and everyone else on the line, including Gus. And that's all I had on my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. If we can get folks who haven't shared, we can get all of those folks, and then we'll go back to get Codified Software Developer. And I guess as we are picking up the people who have not shared, you all can answer Ivy's question if you are so inclined as we proceed. Folks, we have missed completely. I'll give out the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we've not heard from at all.
Can't be heard.
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone. I just first start off to attempt to answer Ivy's question based on what I think I heard her ask. I'll just say from my experiences, being around white people on a 24-hour basis, I've actually seen them talking about helping people, save people's lives, non-white black people lives. And they'll come right back to that fire station and practice racism. Mr. Fuller, as most of us, if not all of us, know, that he states that if a white person is capable of practicing racism, he or she probably is a racist, a practicing racist. Just from the account of a white person being nice, or even going to the extent of at the risk of their own life, saving a life of a non-white person, there is nothing in my experiences that would tell me to basically relax and just I hear some noise in the background. It just went away. Okay. Just because a white person does some kind things or some good things, it still doesn't dictate that I'm supposed to lower my alertness on them potentially being able to practice racism, white supremacy. Gus, quick question. Have you ever heard of a non-white black male by the name of Edwin T. Pratt?
No, sir.
Well, I would like to introduce you to this person. I'll just start off by on how I found out about this person. I think I was on YouTube or something like that on the computer, and they were interviewing this white female somewhere between the ages of 8 to 13 that was playing in a park, she said, and she observed of this plaque that was in this park that had Edwin T. Pratt on it, born 1930, died 1969, and she decided to study this. You know, these are some of the stories that refined racists put on Yahoo or or somewhere to kind of like give the idea that there are some nice white people that's not willing to practice racism and white supremacy, you know, that type of thing. And basically what she did was do some research of her own and found out about this person, non-white black male, as I mentioned. And she said she found out based on all the things that he's done in his life, he should be more recognized in the city of Seattle, Washington. And she went to different council meetings, and they ended up relinquishing her insight. And they named a couple more institutions after him. Come to find out that Mr. Pratt was born in Miami, Florida. He was I'll just cut it short. He became the head of the Urban League, I believe, in Seattle, Washington, during that time. And he was actually assassinated. He was actually assassinated, very similar to Medgar Evers. Medgar Evers was killed attempting to enter his house, where Mr. Pratt was killed by answering his door to his house. It was a house that he purchased for himself and his family in an area that was called Shoreline. Are you familiar with that? That name?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Evidently, he was apparently, if not the first, one of the first black families in that area, which may be, it still is a big mystery behind his assassination, because to this day, they have not came up with solving his murder, his assassination. The only thing that they have reported is that it was three people involved, two people who met him at his door, and the getaway driver. Now I'm trying to figure out, if they knew all of that, how come they haven't found out, you know, exactly who did this over all this time? And I just thought the story was interesting in that light, from the standpoint that he was murdered in a non-white black male who was attempting to do something constructive in regards to the system of racist white supremacy as far as solving the problem. And he was murdered in Seattle, Washington, and he was born in Miami, Florida. If I have a little bit more time, also from the standpoint of you get a couple of clips on the fire department, you it seems that you do that just about every compensatory Saturday. But there's something special about being around white people on a 24-hour basis that I would say probably a lot of non-white people don't have that experience, to actually see them. And when you're at a fire station, just imagine you're at your house. That most people, what they have in their house, that's within a fire station. And there's some places that are strategic, like the television. The television is going to spurn conversation, or at least comments. We all, you know, we look on the computer, we see something, a story and whatnot, you have a comment section. And if it's one, and there's a lot of them alluding to race or racism, and you see the comments by white people, you can just know that there are white people who are making these nasty comments. Well, I experienced them saying making the comments live, you know, as far as their comments are concerned. So that's the specialty about, and I learned a lot during those 20 some odd years around being around white people that I didn't know prior to, you know. I mean, I guess you can make volumes out of it as far as books is concerned. So those are some of the things, thoughts of that. Also with the mentoring program, the group visited a place called Aledo Park, which is a quote-unquote national park. and to go canoeing. And I didn't go because, you know, normally I'm on duty at my mother now is at her home and her children. And I'm one of the five who's taking care of her directly. So that's what I do, you know, after I get through doing things around my own place. Last but not least, with the beach areas, you know, I mean, can you think about just everybody, just think about this, that you have a group of people who actually have basically taken over something that they did not create, which is the beautiful shores on this earth, build buildings so people cannot egress and ingress to the shores, to the ocean. I am familiar with it by being down here in South Florida. You have an area that's called Miami Beach. There's quite a few lot more areas involved that basically saying, no, you're not going to experience this. You're not going to be able to go to get out of your car or walk to this beach and benefit from what the creator created. I'm going to stop you from doing it. That's someone that is unforgivable as far as what my behavior would be to them. Unforgivable. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged. Posted information about Mr. Pratt on the Facebook page. The 10-year-old suspected racist said that she thought there ought to be, or I can read the sentence. It was just a lack of recognition that really, I think, maybe stunned me, Sarah said. It just felt like he's got to have something more than just a plaque outside a bathroom. That's about the size of what you can expect for Negros. If that, a plaque outside the bathroom. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you had commentary, proceed.
I'm Matthew.
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, everyone. This is Irie in New Orleans. And I had a question, but to answer, I'm not sure who asked the question about how do you distance yourself from the niceness of white people? For me, my experience is that whenever a white person is nice, it's one of two things. They're either acting out of ego or they are in a position where their status as white hasn't served them well. And they're kind of like in the doldrums and, you know, they're kind of like, okay, well, I guess I got to hang with you, so I might as well be nice to you, you know, kind of situation. I had an experience 2 years ago that I didn't realize was a white lady practicing racism. She invited my son. She's very, very wealthy. Somehow, I think, a family with the people that started Motorola. And I was in a wealthy school district in Illinois at the time. And she invited my son to go to the lake house with her two sons, her husband, in Lake Geneva. And they went kayaking and some other stuff, you know. And at the time, I was not as informed as I am now. I was more confused. And, you know, I thought it was a good thing to let him go because I figured he would see what it's like to, you know, if you do well, this is what you could possibly have. Well, later on, I was hurt on my job and waiting for my disability benefits to begin. And the same lady that was also nice and I love him, like he can come over whenever. I asked her for a $1,200 loan. And they probably spent more than that the weekend that they went up to Lake Geneva. I said, hey, you know, I want to pay you back. I'm going to pay you back. I'm just waiting on disability benefits to begin. And it'll begin this date. I have, you know, the paperwork. She basically told me, I can't loan you this money. It's, you know, we don't have it. Maybe you should go sell cookies in front of the store like everyone else does. And that was it. I was written off. And so there's that experience. And again, if they're nice, it's because they're down on their luck. I do have a acquaintance. He was a friend. I'm distancing myself from him. He is a swirler, what they call a swirler. He's tried to swirl with me. I told him no. And basically the reason why he, I think in his mind, is cool with me is because he considers himself Black and he's not able to
can,
be.
If I could yes, pause sir. Just for 1 second. I think swirling is a metaphor. And I think that might even be a food metaphor, because I think people generally, when they say swirling, it's vanilla and chocolate. Yeah, buddy. So if we could get the correct term, please. Thank you kindly.
Yes, sir. I will correct it. He seeks out. I got a cowbell. He seeks out tragic arrangements because, again, he's down on his luck, and that's the end of that. I'll move on. There is great, they really do go out of their way to prevent our access to shorelines, and waterways. I don't know if people are familiar with what's going on with Reverend Pinckney in Benton Harbor, where Whirlpool is basically trying to find a way to get these homeowners out of Benton Harbor, Michigan, which is, lakefront property. Because they want to turn it into a resort, a golf club for, whatever. And Reverend Pinckney, he tried to, he embarked on some kind of recall for either the mayor or the governor. I can't recall right now. And because of his actions, he actually was jailed for, I believe, 2 years. They accused him of a crime, tampering with voter registration, and then it came out and he was vindicated and they got him out of jail. And you can look up information on him on Black Agenda Radio. But they love to hog the ocean. They love to hog the water. And the question that I had was, since somebody mentioned NPR practicing refined racism, I was wondering if anybody listens to Harry Shear. His podcast is called Le Show, L-E Show. He is the voice of Mr. Burns on The Simpsons and some other characters. And so far, I haven't caught anything that is, I'm not sure. I do notice that he does love to play second line music, what we call second line music in New Orleans, the local Black brass bands. He loves to play their music in between segments and stuff. And I don't know. I'm just wondering what people think if they do listen to him. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you, everybody.
For sure. I haven't heard his program to comment, but other folks, other people we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, Emmy, we can hear you.
Awesome. Greetings, beautiful people. I will try to be brief and concise. First, I would be lying if I didn't say I didn't celebrate holidays, horror days. I'm not that quite codified yet. I still really, really love New Year's. I really like birthdays. I love birthdays. And I really, really like Mother's Day and Father's Day. Those are the ones that I've, still haven't let go. And being that it's so close to Father's Day and, practically a few minutes away from it, but also some other things that have happened in my life, I've really been giving a lot of thought to the importance of men and the value of men, specifically Black men, my relationship with Black men, my conflict, internal conflict with Black men, my confusion, all of that. All of that pretty much just became very apparent, became very obvious. And, I take those as blessings when, something is in your face and you have to deal with all the ways that you feel about it. And so I really appreciated the Black male who moved from Virginia to North Carolina, even though it's just like the next state, who cares? To be with his daughter and started his organization and did all that he did and is doing all that he's doing. I really, really, really appreciate that. I no longer have social media, but when I did, I had Instagram. I was almost addicted or obsessed with the like pages or video clips or images of black daddies doing their girl's hair, black daddies taking the kids for the day, black daddies just doing black daddy stuff, black daddies with their sons, just black fathers. I think the image is just so powerful for me. And so, but I don't have it anymore, so I don't get that dose of awesomeness. But anyway, I appreciated the clip. And I'm fortunate and blessed, I guess, or not, depending on how you look at it. I'm a divorced child. My mother remarried and my father remarried too. Everybody is still alive, so I guess someone could argue that I have four, but I'm not going to get into my personal life, could argue I have four parents. But when it comes to my mother and the man that she married, and I've already admitted on here that at one point someone could say that I was very disrespectful and just swirling out of control and confused and hurt and traumatized and all this other kind of stuff, and it was true. And I had to work through all of that. But I'm so grateful now that I'm much more mature and I've done some work. I'm not sitting up saying, oh, my God, I don't have no issues. Oh, I got daddy issues. That's just me being honest. But I'm so grateful for the man that married my mom and has functioned as a father and a dad for me. I also still have my dad, and that is what it is. And we're all victims, so I really got an opportunity to really, you know, accept and let go at the same time. You know, it is what it is. But, you know, I just wanted to make sure that I really spoke about that, because even though there's a lot of hurt and pain, there's also a lot of good things too. And I'm just very fortunate. And I think that if I hadn't had that, it's very easy. I hear it all the time. Black men don't do this. Black men don't do that. Black men don't want to be daddies. They don't want to take care of their kids, blah, blah, blah. But that's not true. I'm out here trying to date or whatever, and I meet black men who have kids all the time. And I watch how much they love their kids and their children. And maybe they can't always provide, which I'm getting to the point of what the man said who started his organization. When the white interviewer asked him, like, what is the one thing that I guess you would say? And he said, it doesn't matter how much money that you spend. A lot of times the black fathers get caught up on thinking they got to buy the extra expensive tennis shoes or the extra this or the extra that, when really all the kids want is their attention and their love. And that, for me, made it, took away any of the disbelief or mistrust I might have had about his intentions, because that's a very real thing. A lot of the men, like, and I won't say a lot, I can't qualify it that way, but there are a lot of men who love their kids but cannot provide. And there's a lot of men who can provide but don't necessarily have that feeling. And then there's a lot of people all in between. But for the ones who really do love and can't provide, the women will do exactly what he described for him. And I see that all the time, will use the children as weapons. And so there's a lot to work out. But I just really wanted to comment on that, because black men hold a very, 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 very special place, like in my life, where I'm at in my life now. And I just don't think that we love on them enough, if we could even say love on. I don't know if it's a metaphor or whether people believe in it or not, but give them just space, I guess, to really like work it all out. And so I wanted to comment on that. I'm sorry, let me just pull up what I was trying to say, because I kind of went someplace else. Gus, moron is name calling, and there should not be any name calling, even when we say it to ourselves. White people feign niceness to me all the time. They also are, you know, very trifling terroristic and all that too. But there are a lot of white people who act like they're nice to me all the time. And it doesn't make me no difference whatsoever. I reciprocate, like, you know, I'll be appreciative because that's part of my code and how I'm able to maneuver, in my opinion, based off of the assessment that I've made. They hold all the keys, and there's places I'm trying to go and things I'm trying to do. So if you provide me an opportunity, I'm not going to deny it because you're white. Like, that's not strategic, in my opinion. But I'm not going to become your groupie either. So thank you for the opportunity, and I keep it moving because I feel like that's what they're supposed to do given all that they've put, what they're doing now and their establishment of the system of racism, white supremacy. So sometimes I have to walk a very strategic line, not to use a metaphor. And then if I do feel any inclination, like maybe, oh, like I want to be nice to you, or could it, well, maybe, no. Number one, there's enough evidence to suggest that we're so conditioned to be immediately accepting of white people that that is just absolutely dangerous. So I keep that at the forefront of my mind, that something inside of me, no matter how codified I try to become, no matter how much I try to exorcise that out of me, it is there. So, like, it would be easy for a white, like, if I wasn't staying on that reality that I am conditioned, I am programmed, and I work against it on a daily basis to make sure I stay present and remain logical and not caught up in my feelings, because these feelings were given to me from commercials before I stopped watching TV, from everything around me is trying to pull me to be that way with white people. So I just reject that. And that's, hopefully that helps. And then the last thing I wanted to say is regarding the beaches. Now, I told you I have a stepfather, but I don't call him that. My dad, he's from Miami. His mother is in Miami. She worked for a white family that lived on the beach, who completely took advantage of her. She raised their children, like, she made their family what it was. They live on the beach. She had never been to the beach until my mother and my dad took her to the beach, maybe not even that long ago. And she's in her 80s, but lives in Miami, like in Miami. So I just figured I would share that. And then here's a tip that might be helpful for anybody else out there like me dealing with things. Sometimes I'm lazy. I do a lot and I get tired and I don't want to do anything else and I'm just tired. And so I don't really write as much as I used to. When I was younger, I wrote all the time, like journals upon journals of tears and pain and all that kind of stuff. But now I'm just too tired to write. So I actually use my recorder and I talk to myself. I don't know if y'all think that's crazy or not, but I'm not, I don't care. So far it's been very helpful. And so maybe if you are not like a writer, but you still need to get your thoughts out, maybe recording yourself speaking and just kind of keeping like a electronic voice recorder, diary, journal thing, what might be helpful to get stuff out of you. So thank you all for listening.
Much obliged, Emmy. Thank you for sharing. No name calling, indeed. Other folks we've missed completely, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Hello, can I be heard?
Go ahead, ma'am.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am, Puff. Proceed.
Oh, okay. Hello, everyone, and I'd like to say Happy Father's Day early to all of the callers, the male callers that are on the phone, and I just wanted to say that retired firefighter, I hope his mom do well. And that's it.
Ashe, second that. Thank you for yielding the floor.
Thank you.
Indeed. Caller in Florida, thank you for yielding to Puff, if you had commentary.
Oh, yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I was just thinking about how they had the I guess, that planned summit in, I think, Singapore with Trump and I think his name is Kim Jong-un or something like that. I believe that was the firefighter who mentioned the body language analysis. I did see that practice with suspected racist Donald Trump when he shook the hand of the non-white person. He grabbed his arm. Like, I don't know if anyone saw that, because they did have like a body language interpreter on TV, and they kept using the word dominance, that Trump was dominant, and he just put his hands on his back, and he was the leader of the exchange and the encounter. And they were using the word leader and dictator toward the non-white person, the Asian male. And then there was a comment also, I think that was Rudy Giuliani. He said that we need to make sure that we have him on his hands and knees practicing racism with that comment. And as far as the segment on the Young Turks, where they was trying to, I guess, paraphrase or give their thoughts on how the white person was talking about the immigration and the white fear, genetic annihilation, too many non-white people populating the area. You know, we got to have some more white kids coming into the schools or, you know, whatever it may have been. And they brought it to the Republican thing, and they made it seem like if he was questioned about it, and he says, well, hey, Trump, he gets to say these things. You know, well, I can't do it. And going on Republican, racist focal point, and basically, and the segment with the law enforcement, like, I wonder if everybody caught where, like, because he caught the race soldier saying nigger on his phone, and he said, you know, hey, you're going down, and it's 2018, and I just got to tell my kids about this. And I guess it was a white person, maybe it was someone representing the police department. He says, hey, you know, when you go out there, you know, you may be getting recorded. You may be recorded, so you just want to make sure you're being professional. I guess trying to make it seem like he shouldn't, don't practice racism, okay? Like, go out there and be professional. Definitely a code word. Don't say or do anything that would be perceived as racist. And one last thing, I was looking at a older Malcolm X interview, and they had a white person on it, and it was from 1963, and the white person used the term compensatory action. And I was like, I was amazed by that, because I hadn't really heard that term outside of Mr. Fuller using it. Well, it's not exactly the same term, but he used that word in a interview with Malcolm X. And that's the only thing I have right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
That is interesting. I don't often hear that term invoked, compensatory. Not very often, particularly someone who's, you know, not speaking from Mr. Fuller's concepts. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm a second time caller, and I know the Dr. Rassayan on, and he was talking about the older Superfly movie.
Right, that was
and
discussed.
I recently
go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I recently just interested in just sharing some of my observations with my movie experience and like a couple of spoilers, I guess.
What movie is this you said you wanted to talk about? Because we don't do entertainment on the compensatory call-in. What movie did you say you wanted to talk about?
The Superfly 2018, because Dr. Rassayan.
Oh, man.
Spoke about the,
Jesus Lord.
Yeah.
this is a movie I have no intention of seeing. So, man, how much value do I put on a review of Superfly? 30 seconds. You can give it to me in 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, I'm still in the movie, though. I guess for the audience was all black. There's and then three black females with two couples out of that. And I will say that the level of just the degeneracy in the film was at an all-time high, the highest I've ever seen. And I'm under 25, so I haven't seen the original Superfly, but I would just say avoid the film at all costs. It's scary because the people my age are going to go out and see this movie and not think anything of it.
Wow. Well, if I was like Mr. Fuller's age, or even Dr. Rassayan's age, or even 50 or 45, if I was like, you know, older, I think then I would just say, I'm out of touch. That's what it is. I'm out of touch and that sort of thing. But no, I've just been curmudgeon for quite some time now. And really, the most important thing is the anti-blackness in these films. Once you see what you're looking at, as Mr. Fuller says, I just don't see how you can have a lot of black self-respect and, you know, watch this content and maintain sanity, black self-respect. I just don't think, you know, viewing Superfly, either version, Black Panther, or any of them, but maybe I'm in error. Folks, we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Good evening, Buff.
Thomas in New York.
Greetings to all the callers. Superfly, man. Great soundtrack back in the days. That's about it. I love that clip from American History X. When you play that clip, I mean, it's so clear cut to the point of, in my opinion, how the majority of people labeled as white think. Was how that young man described when his father passed away in the fire. I just love that clip. I really wish that they would leave these white monuments alone. I believe that, and this is my opinion, that instead of knocking them down, we should be protesting to have a plaque put in front of them explaining who these people were and what they did. And let them explain after that why are those monuments still there. To me, they're not going to take their monuments down. It's just as that other clip you play, I don't think you played it this big, but it's just more lip service. And now, like you said, now they got the black people to blame for it. And it's just preposterous. You know, they put them there for a reason. Let us explain what the reason that statue's there for. And let them explain, put a plaque right in front of it. That's my opinion. First responders who break the white code and get caught making racist comments should be fired immediately. In my opinion, they make life or death decisions. And I'm talking about not only firefighters, police officers, also EMS. I remember when Eric Garner was choked and the EMS worker refused to perform mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on that, you know, big black, you know, man. Once again, they're making life or death decisions. How fast they respond to a fire, how fast they respond to a crime, how they're going to interact with people. You know, all those things they should be held accountable, especially since the taxpayers are paying their money. The shorelines brings me back to Assata Shakur's book. Her family owns significant shorelines in the Carolinas, and they were had white supremacists removed them from that land. I believe at one point they owned the beach, but they couldn't go in the water. If it wasn't that book, it was another one. But it's such a history. I remembered my family. I have family members who lived in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And if you ever been to Atlantic City, you know, every time I had gone there before I went to visit them, you know, you see the boardwalk and all the whole casinos and the amusement park and everything like that, the beach. You go two or three blocks off the beach, and one of the worst, quote-unquote, ghettos you'll ever see. One of the poorest, like a shanty town. Some of the shacks people lived in, I was appalled. Those shore towns down in Jersey, I'm sure probably all the way down the east and west coast that have black people, especially in the northeast where the towns are dependent upon the 3 months of the summer to make money. The rest of the, you know, once those tourists leave, it's a desolate black town. You know, when you go there, it's really shocking, especially since you stay on the beach. When you go as a tourist, you know, you're not going a few blocks away. Last thing I'm going to mention is Trump's new immigration policy. I agree with it. And I can't wait for the wall to come up. And I think that we have enough confused victims to add more confused victims to this whole mixture here. We need, you know, unconfuse the victims we already have. And in my opinion, this will just add to the confusion. The firefighter, I spoke to him one day, and he was telling me there's a whole part of Miami where all the Spanish-speaking people are white. And they don't even speak a bit of English. I mean, that's very confusing. I mute my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Anybody that we have missed completely? Anybody that has a hand up that we've not heard from at all? Did we get everybody? Spectacular. I'll try to respond to Ivy's question. She said, how do people emotionally distance themselves from whites who are helpful? And I think Mr. Fuller has that specifically in his code book about at times it benefits racist man, racist woman, racist child to be helpful to a non-white person. So sometimes they might do lots of things that are beneficial, that are constructive. But I think for us, the most important thing is this is still someone who's classified as white. This is still someone who is operating, functioning as a racial race soldier, most likely. Got to suspect that at minimum. So in my opinion, regardless of what they do, it's just how do I classify? Am I thinking that, oh, this is a great white person who did something nice or what have you? It just starts with that for me. If I'm consistently thinking this is a race soldier. If I'm in a situation, yoga teacher training school starts on Wednesday. Anna Brown Griswold, that's super helpful. Go get training. Great. She's paying the whole tab. Still a suspected race soldier. Oh, she admitted. Whoops. Admitted racist. That's the most important thing. I think I've talked about this before. That is huge just in how we talk about, think about, it's just business. This person doing something nice for me, that doesn't change anything. We're not homies. We're not friends. There's nothing jolly and there's nothing to celebrate, regardless of how nice a white person or what a white person did. They have the ability to do lots of nice things. They could have gave out that $1,200. They could have made that a $12,000 loan, probably. No big deal. You stole everything. I think Ivy said it. They're just giving you back what they already stole from you anyway. In little crumbs, in fact, of what they stole from you, literally. So that's what I would do. Just keep that in mind. I'm dealing with a race soldier. At times, racist, they can be pleasant. That's a part of the package of being a master deceiver. And I've even heard racists say sometimes it works best when you can be kind. You can be nice. You might even be kind and nice most of the time. But then that one day you got to come in. Now I got to be terroristic. And then once we get through this, we got Thomas Jefferson. Apparently, I read that article today. They said he was very kind. I'll mute my line. Other folks we have not heard from.
Can I add to that, Gus?
Thomas in New York.
In the non-areas of people activity, including health, and any other areas that people want to add to that list, they put themselves in a position where they're the only people that can help you. If they're helping me, I feel as though that's the least they could do, and that's just how I look at it. I don't look at it as anything more than that. I don't get emotionally attached to them helping me. I'm like, yo, I got them to help me, good. I'm going to roll with it. As soon as it stops, I'm going to the next one. I mean, in most cases, who else are you going to get to help? I mean, my line of thinking.
Did you have comments?
Can I be heard?
Listen to Brad in Nevada first.
Two things. I'm probably going to start adding more commentary about the opioid quote unquote crisis from Ohio, because there's a lot more information from there than here. There was an article that came out in the Columbus Dispatch, and it was on today, where the CDC said that the fentanyl getting with first responders, since that was something that has been spoken about over this call, they're not as much as in risk of getting getting an overdose from touching the fentanyl as it has been proposed. And they said that, you know, it would take very large quantities over an extended period of time. So I know, like, whites, they like to over-exaggerate when they're in quote-unquote danger. And then, of course, when they over-exaggerate it, that's when they're able to get funding and you know, just making sure that their problem is resolved very quickly, or this quote-unquote problem is resolved very quickly. And one other there was a part in the article, and it says, the article is actually called, if anyone's interested, it says CDC, first responders' fear of touching fentanyl, perhaps overblown. And it says that U.S. Senate Sherrod Brown, that's the Democrat from Ohio, important Democrat, and then for those who are maybe more confused, and then also Rob Portland, a Republican, also of Ohio, they proposed a Senate bill that would pump millions of dollars into purchasing high-tech devices that detect fentanyl and other substances in an effort to keep officers safe when encountering the deadly substance. So that was just, like, I'm, you know, really focusing more on they're putting millions of dollars, taking millions of dollars out of, you know, non-white people, taking millions of dollars away from non-white people and making sure that this is supposed to correct their problem. There was also another article, and it spoke about how there's this Canadian company. They came out with a fentanyl testing strip to where they would give it out, and Ohio has been giving it out to these junkies that they could test their drug. If they wanted to test a little bit of their drug with water, the test would let them know if it has fentanyl in it or not. And then from there, they'll be able to, you know, want to take the chance if they want to take the drug. And then the last thing, just about the white people, I know I spoke about it on workplace racism. I have to constantly train myself whenever the supervisor, my manager, tries to say nice things to me. Like recently, she's been kind of making it seem as if, you know, we're really hardworking girls, you know, we're from the same type of area, and so, you know, you're really one of the better people. That's something, and I know in my mind it's like how good I'm doing reflects good on her. So I know this is not just something that she's just saying to be nice. It's something that, you know, I don't take it as nice in my mind. Whenever she's giving me these quote unquote compliments, I always think, you know, this is just still a race soldier, and I should still I file it in my mind, but still I don't take it as where this is something that I really. It's going to change my mind about her. Now mute my line. Thank you.
Codified software developer in Wisconsin. Did you have commentary you were going to add?
Yes, sir. Thank you for letting me speak again. So I just wanted to answer Ivy's question specifically about the white male who gives me constructive information. I think actually Gus, retired firefighter, and Emmy and now Red have all said very constructive things, particularly Emmy, about the conditioning that we have. I would not beat myself up, even if you feel grateful or gratitude, just knowing and understanding that you've been conditioned to feel that way, and also knowing and understanding that you have been and your and the people who have come before you, your antecedents have been subjected to severe terrorism, and we're experiencing a great deal of Stockholm syndrome. It's very important so you can interrogate that. That's incredibly important. Also, Gus and retired firefighter both spoke on Neely Fuller. Retired firefighter in particular spoke about if this person is able, this person is classified as white and is able to be a racist, most likely they are one or they will be practicing racism. And Gus talking about, you know, just having the knowledge that this is a race soldier. In particular, what helped me with this white male is that even though he has not practiced racism against me, he has practiced racism against other non-white people, whether directly or indirectly. So I know that, and that keeps that fresh in my mind. And I've found that white males, when they're being quote-unquote nice to you, it usually means they want to sexually sewer you in the first place, and that's why they're being nice. And in his case, he is trying to, contrast himself with the sexual terrorist who tried to hit me in the car in the first place, who was also trying to sexually sewer me. So he's just trying to play the nice guy against the sexual terrorist who also tried to play the nice. It's actually very fascinating pathology, and I really, it's really very interesting to observe these people when they are doing what they're doing. But any white person who's being quote unquote nice is usually doing it for an ulterior motive. And so we always have to be mindful of that. And like Gus said, just have in the back of your mind, this is a race soldier. This is my enemy. I am behind enemy lines. At any time, this person could do something incredibly dangerous, incredibly damaging to me. Thanks so much. I'll mute my line.
Nebier?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to quickly say thank you, everybody. Thank you, Gus, Codified, software developer, Emmy, the retired firefighter, Red, everybody. Incredible, and I can't wait to record this tomorrow to like download it, listen to it over and over again, and just study it to help me with just, you know, my emotionalism. Like, this has just been extremely encouraging and helpful. And it's so funny, Codify software developer, that you talked about him possibly having sexual interest in you. I thought about that and wondered that, like, is that a motive? For whatever reason, it seemed like that could have been the case, maybe because that was like the only option I thought of in terms of an ulterior motive, but that definitely crossed my mind. I hope that's not a metaphor. If it is, I do apologize, and I'll mute my line.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just want to add two things really quickly. I'm wondering if you're familiar with 48 Laws of Power, because in the book they give the laws and a short statement, and two that always stand out to me is play a sucker to catch a sucker, and always despise the free lunch. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because in regard to niceness, you know, that is a tactic that they use with themselves, among themselves, in order to snare people into bad things. And anything that's being given away with some type of appearance of generosity or, you know, gratis, you know, it's always something that will be taken away from you if you receive it. And I also think about the legal term and the Latin term quid pro quo, this for that. So there's always an exchange, especially with people that, you know, are our sworn enemy. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Irie. Any other folks dialed in with a hand up or anyone have a final concise comment they want to get in before we conclude?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Crystal.
Yes. I would say probably what I call professional kindness may have been a white invention, professional kindness. Baron von Richthofen, World War II fighter ace, was shot down by other white people, but he was given a first-class funeral, you know, by his enemies. White people had something that was called a Geneva Convention. Now, mind you, now they were killing each other. But at the same time, from the standpoint of capture and how they would actually treat the white enemy with respect, in this part of the world, the Nazi POWs were allowed to roam through the southern states to go where non-white people couldn't even go, you know, as far as they're concerned. So they definitely know how to exhibit that behavior to their victims, especially when they have an agenda in mind. So I would say to not only Miss Ivy, but everybody else, keep that in mind on who you're dealing with when you're dealing with a white person. They're very well disciplined in their professional kindness behavior and agenda. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They master deceivers that can be practiced, manifested in a variety of ways. With that, we have done our 3 hours. I'll state again, major part of our counter-racism code, at least in my view, not spending money to go to the movies. Black Panther, $1 billion, probably $8 billion by now. But that's one thing that we could do. I don't think there's anything that's going to play at the cinema that is going to lead to us coming up with a new concept to eradicate white terrorism. I think that would be money and time and energy better spent on other things. Dr. Welsing, consistently, reading is more important than watching TV. And I mean, even if you got to see the film or what have you, I mean, you can wait on it. At least, you know, hey, if I got to see it, at least have the discipline, the economic discipline, say, well, at least I'm not going to spend $20, you know, to go see it at the theater or even a matinee or what have you. I'll wait. I can get it, you know, from the library, watch it online, whatever the case. I'm sure you can figure out a way if you wait even a few weeks sometimes, you'll be able to see it for free, no problem. Whites make their white supremacist entertainment readily available, including Six Flags. With that, thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll be here tomorrow. That's Sunday, 3 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. We will be chatting about the summit, the Grenfell Tower fire inquiry. Lots of non-white people suffered there. Looking forward to tomorrow. Tune in. Take an opportunity to ask questions, non-white people in different parts of the planet. If you have questions, guest suggestions, gripes, question, or shouldn't be any questions about the t-shirts, they should be arriving so you can just write about your experience wearing the shirt. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Thank you kindly for all the folks participating. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. I will again suggest sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Think about the New York Fire Department, drunken melee. Sobriety would be best. And I mean, wow. Worthy. You hear that right there on cue? One of the worst combinations in the known universe. White's alcohol. I bet I would be willing to wager a substantial amount of money. It's Saturday night, so-called holiday weekend. I suspect wherever they're going, alcohol might have played a role in the reason that they're going down the streets siren ablaze. Sobriety would be best. Along with that, you just heard that siren. If you're going to be out and about in a vehicle, sober and buckled up, whether you're a driver or passenger, let's do everything that we possibly can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.